This is Richard Varun. I'm continuing my interview with Ambassador Fong. Today is January 24th, 2003. Sir, right now in Paris, they're having a meeting, a conference, marking the 40th anniversary of the signing of the Paris Peace Agreements. And unfortunately, you were not invited to this meeting. But I'd like to give you a chance to talk about it now, if you'd like. And what are your feelings on what's happening there? Why do they have this? Obviously, they're having this commemoration to mark 40 years. But what do you think the purpose of the meeting really is?
Well, it's amazing to begin with that you can mark the 30th mm-hmm. anniversary of the signing of the Paris Agreement mm-hmm. this year.
The 30th, right, not the 40th.
2003.
Right.
It was signed on the 27th of January of the year 1973. Mm-hmm. And as you know, it was signed by the four foreign ministers of the four delegations. Mm-hmm. That is Secretary William Rogers for the United States, Mr. Nguyen Trinh for the Hanoi government, Madame Nguyen Thi Minh for the PRG, that is State NMF, the mm-hmm. Viet Cong, it's come to be referred to, and by Mr. Tung Van Lam, who was at that time the foreign minister of the Saigon government. Mm-hmm. Well, what they call the Colloque International, which is organized in Paris, and the first meeting is just for today, mm-hmm. the 24th of January, and it will continue also tomorrow, the 25th, Saturday, at the very place where the signing of the Paris Agreement took place 30 years ago. That was the old Hotel Majestic, mm-hmm. a very nice place, enormous place, which then was given to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of the French government to become the international center for conferences. Mm-hmm. And that was where the Paris talks took place from January 1969 to January 1973. And the Paris Agreement supposedly to end the war and restore peace in Vietnam took place. I was expected to attend mm-hmm. The meeting today, but they wouldn't list me on the official speakers and accept for me to be present and ask for the floor. So I said I wouldn't ask for the floor. But in fact, we have Professor Larry Berman participating, and also our Ambassador William participating there. Probably they may consider those two people more moderate than me.
Do you think that's why you were not given an official listing on the program?
Probably. And since I was the one who really had the continuity, mm-hmm. you know, from the very beginning in 1968, even at the time of Ambassador Harriman and Ambassador Cyrus Vance, and then also Madame Bin, who was there right at the beginning till the end, that is until 1973. I even continued after 1973, because according to the provisions of the Paris Agreement, the two Saigonese parties also had the continuation of the Paris talks, mm-hmm. Which became the Conference of La Saint-Cloud. I was then also with that conference of La Saint-Cloud, mm-hmm. which was headed by Mr. Nguyen Văn Thiệu for the PRG mm-hmm. at the beginning. So the present Colloque International, which is taking place now right in Paris, I think it is organized by the group of professors from the French universities, academics. And it is very clear that they are all, shall we say, leftist. Mm-hmm. And the subject for the colloque is supposed to be the American intervention in the Vietnam War and the positions of the European governments to that American intervention in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can expect what they will say. You know. Anyway, I have responded to Professor Christopher Gosha, who's also on the managing committee mm-hmm. of the caucus. The only point of interest that come to my mind for such a colloquium would be to understand better the position taken by the French government in the cities 1960s concerning the Vietnam War,
mm-hmm.
because by 1965 Jean de Gaulle, while visiting Phnom Penh, made a very famous declaration claiming that the whole Indochinese peninsula, that is Laos, Cambodia and Vietnam, should be a zone of neutrality. And so we try to understand that when we arrived in Paris in 1968 and then right afterwards at the opening of the Paris talks in 1969, January 1969, we try very hard to understand that notion of neutrality by Jean de Gaulle.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to us that even the French Foreign Ministry was not very, you know, clear how to understand that notion of neutrality proposed by Jean de Gaulle at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And at this colloquium international, there will be also Ambassador Fomar Maurice. He was the director of the Asia Pacific desk of the French Foreign Ministry.
Mm-hmm.
During the time of the Paris talks, eventually he became the French ambassador to Moscow and so on. I also was able to see Ambassador Fomar Maurice later after 1975. He's very bitter about the whole history. But he was not able to explain even that notion of neutrality in them. With also Mr. Henri Boll, who was directly responsible for Vietnam. Issue at the French Foreign Ministry, and eventually I also had a meeting, a discussion with Mr. Michel Debray, who was the French Foreign Minister at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And the man is a very hard man. Michel Debray is well known to be a very, you know, a forceful personality. And of course he was completely against the American policy.
Mm-hmm.
But he was not even able to explain that notion of neutrality, and in the end we had a very heated discussion, and he came to the only explanation possible of Jean de Gaulle's notion of neutrality. He claimed that North Vietnam and South Vietnam, that is the Saigon government and the Hanoi government, could take a neutral attitude and claim neutrality in their action, because I said that it would be very difficult for both North Vietnam and South Vietnam to be neutral since they have military alliances in the armed conflict going on at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But he said that you can have your own different political systems and still remain neutral. Okay? I said that I use a French expression in that discussion. I said it seems to me it is splitting hair in four. That's how the French call it. But that was it. I mean, France, with her past in Indochina, has always wanted to return to Indochina and assume a role there. Once the American influence is removed, even right now, but France is no longer really military or economic power, you know, with the capability
mm-hmm.
to put its weight in the, trying to resolve the Vietnam War. The basic issue, of course, when talking to the French, because they try to find a formula by which they could, I suppose, neutralize the various forces playing there, because Indochina fell into the gray area of the Yalta Conference. This is to say, it's not a clear cut of either side, and that was the reason why you had disputes in those gray areas. And either you cut up that Indochinese peninsula and divide it to the powers which had any kind of bearing or influence, mainly the Soviet Union, the PRC, and the United States. So by the geographical or physical division of that Indochinese peninsula, you can have some kind of, you know, stalemate.
Right.
You know, mutual neutralization.
But how long would that last?
As long as those powers were able to exercise their influence and their weight. You know, and if you miss a step there, the other guy will take over. You have also what we call the Balkanization process. That is to say, you have the influences of those powers play together, you know, in a certain area. Mm-hmm. And of course, at the same time, you come to a kind of stalemate too. But by accepting a positive intervention instead of a negative attitude, not to intervene. And that was also, I think, the choice that Prince Sihanouk faced at that time, with the American and particularly the Soviet Union influence in Cambodia, because the Chinese were not yet very much in position to play the game in face of the Soviets and the Americans. And so there we also had the same choice in order to propose, you know, in the negotiations, whether we can have that kind of neutral attitude and neutral position, see? And neutrality there, we understood it at that time could be, as I just said, whether it would be a negative neutrality or positive neutrality. And at that time we used the expression whether you have your hands open up or you have your hands, you know, down. Mm-hmm. That is, you don't receive anything from anybody. That is a negative way to deny the influence of anybody. Mm-hmm. It was at that time a bit the position of the Burmese, you know, and then in the country there was nothing at all, not even toothpaste for you to use, you see. Mm-hmm. Or you have, like Sihanouk, Prince Sihanouk, then you open your hands up and you receive, you know, aid from everybody. Mm-hmm. That would be more, you know, beneficial to the people. That is to say, either you have first-class hospital in Phnom Penh, you know, built by the Russians, and then you have the highways and the Kompon Cham Harbor by the Americans, then you receive aid from everybody. Mm-hmm. So that was also a choice for the Vietnamese, both North and South Vietnam, to consider whether we could do that.
And so you're talking about 1945, right? Right after World War II?
Even in the 60s.
And all the way up into the 60s.
Yeah.
Right.
And that was the basic choice to President Diem, you know, in the early 60s with President Kennedy. Mm-hmm. Because the Diemists continue to claim, even up to today, and that the poor man did not want to internationalize the conflict and resisted very hard the American intervention in Vietnam, and at the same time claimed that he was trying to open up channels with Ho Chi Minh and find a peaceful solution to the thing. They were very laudable, you know, motives on the part of President Ngo Dinh Diem. But the initiative was not in his hand. I mean, the escalation of the war was not in his hand, you know. And the point of dispute now is to determine whether the U.S. escalated the war or it was the Soviets which then through Hanoi escalated the war in that you know, internationalized the confrontation, armed conflict in Vietnam. I mean, President Yu wouldn't be in position to decide or influence on that kind of a choice. And second, The Jimmys claim that he tried to find a solution between the brother enemies, you see. Well, it is a very honorable thing to do, but I doubt very much that Ho Chi Minh and the Vietnam Communist Party would go into any compromise with President Jim.
Right. For neutrality to work, both parties have to honor neutrality.
Yes.
And Ho Chi Minh's side simply had a purpose and goal to Nazis.
And the same story happened again with General Nguyen Khanh. Mm-hmm. When he ousted German Big Minh and took over, and by the beginning of 1965, he continued in the same line and claiming that he wanted to defuse, you know, the armed conflict in Vietnam, and had already contacts with the NLF at that time, with Mr. Nguyen Huc Thọ and Madame Binh, in order to compromise with the Viet Cong. And that would be even a worse situation. Because by, you know, the early 1960s, President Diem had the opportunity, you know, to compromise, so we say in inverted commas, with Ho Chi Minh. And but then with General Khanh in 1965, beginning of 1965, it was even a worse compromise with the Viet Cong, not even with Hanoi, you see. And so you keep on, you know, chopping up, you know, the country in small pieces, instead of bringing it together. And so that was the basic options open to those brother enemies. But I must say that I have never been, you know, attracted or convinced by any possibility of compromise with the communist Vietnamese.
So what would you say now, today, if you were in Paris and you wanted to discuss the French position with regards to the conflict in Vietnam, would the French now admit, yes, we wanted as much influence in Vietnam as possible, and especially after the Americans left, that's, and according to our conversation previous, that's why Big Minh was put in place, or was there ready to take the reins. That's why the French wanted him there, in order, because they knew that he could be controlled or be influenced somewhat by the French, and they would have more of a say in the future of Vietnam and their old colony. I mean, would France today go with that? Would the scholars at this conference debate that point, or is that something that's widely accepted?
You know, I continue to hold on the views I had 30 years ago. And I tried very hard to push those views, which were not accepted by President Hill. But he was open to listen to those views. I recognized the French could play a role in finding a solution to the Vietnam War in 1969, 1970. That was really, for me at that time, the point in time to do something, because that was the moment when all the parties involved faced a choice. See, afterwards, in 1971, 1972, it was just the sequence of events coming from the decisions made in 69, 70, and 71, and I was agreeable to a role which would be possible for the French to play. And in the end, I also very bluntly said to the French that they did not have the means of their policy, you see, and they could not do that alone. So, and they would not do it with the Americans.
No.
And so there was no other choice possible for them to go Chinese on the international scene in order to have any weight in their position, in their say. And they came to admit that the only role that was possible for the French government to play was to be a kind of cement to bring others together. They would not be and the position to have a solution by themselves, but they can help other parties to come to a solution. So I said, fair enough, you see, considering their experience and knowledge. of the area, the traditional ties they always have with the Vietnamese, the Lao, and the Cambodians. Okay. And so, I took the position completely opposite of Hanoi, Saigon, and even the Americans. That is to say, trying to divide, you know, keep on dividing since the 1954 Geneva Agreement, dividing the country in two. And now, it was amazing to me that, you know, Dr. Kissinger, you know, could go into such a contradiction because the U.S. Refused to recognize the Geneva Accords in 1954. That was the time of Mr. Foster Dulles. Did not recognize at all, and President Eisenhower did not recognize the Geneva Accords. That is to say, you have never accepted the notion, which was a good position, mm-hmm. that Vietnam, in Vietnam you have two Vietnams and two peoples, North and South and so on, you see. And in fact, Ho Chi Minh never claimed that there were two Vietnams, you see. Although he claimed that he was in the North, and there was a demarcation line to the 17th parallel that was just a line dividing the conflicting forces, temporary line of demarcation. It was not the vision of the country. When President Diem in 1955 started, you know, to claim that he had, you know, a clear different country called South Vietnam, mm-hmm. and then President Kennedy and then President Johnson, you know, went into that kind of argumentation. Mm-hmm. And even worse, you know, in 1971-72, Dr. Kissinger even claimed that there were even two South Vietnams, not only two Vietnams, but two South Vietnams, right. Two army, two administration. So, you lost the thing completely.
In 1954.
Yeah. And that was the strategic point, militarily, politically, socially, and everything, culturally.
And it was wrong from the very beginning.
Very beginning. And that was the point which did not go through to the people. The people had never accepted the division at the 17th parallel, you see. And when you claim nationalism, you claim sovereignty for a country called South Vietnam, that didn't go in the minds of the ordinary people and the peasants in the countryside. Ho Chi Minh never claimed that, you see. And so, in Paris, in 1969-1970, I tried to convince the French and the Chinese, you see, that instead of dividing all the time, why don't we get together? And with the help of the French, you see, to cement, you know, everybody, and in order to put more weight, you know, to the whole equation, the French would have Beijing, Paris would have Beijing by its side. And so that was the reason why I advanced the idea that we widen the demarcation line and make it a free zone for trade, mm-hmm. to begin with. Mm-hmm. You think? Put the political notions aside for the moment, mm-hmm. you think? And let help the people there get a better life to begin with. Anybody can come in. You know, the Russians, the Americans, and the Europeans, and everybody, and particularly the Japanese, they would jump into there, Hong Kong, Singapore, and Taiwanese weather, you know, and that would also be a point of a meeting for Beijing and Taiwan, you know, at the same time. But that can be done. That could be done, you see, at that time. And then you have buffer zones, you know, on either side of that so-called free market zone, mm-hmm. and then eventually you have a kind of integration, osmosis process, you know, and bring, you know, economic development in those things, you know, and not have disputes on sovereignties and you know, political issues and so on, which were not of much interest to the ordinary people anyway.
What about the fact that Ho Chi Minh's North Vietnam had one single goal, and that was to take the whole country and make it a communist country? They wouldn't honor the buffer zone.
There was no doubt in anybody's mind that the final aim an objective of Ho Chi Minh and the Vietnam Communist Party was to have communist rule on the whole of the country. And they thought that they were in position to get it. The only problem was that to convince them, and I think it was the American policy as well, to show them and dissuade them that they would not have it very quick.
Right.
They may have it, you know, in 10, 20, 50 years' time, but not right away. That was the way of dissuasion. Mm-hmm. Because in the end, you know, the American policy was just a policy of dissuasion, in fact, because you did not have really the initiative, you know, in that armed conflict. Now you got yourself into something which was an open end, you know, because the guy was in his own country.
Right.
He claimed, you know, to be in his own house, and you just came, you know, from half of the world there to have a fight with him. Mm-hmm. You see. So, I think that the international situation also helped at that time to persuade Hanoi that it will have to wait for a while before it could take, you know, the whole of country by force of arms, which was a combination of what they call the people's warfare, conventional war with guerrilla warfare, terrorism, and all the new notions of popular war.
Do you think with this buffer zone that you described in place, and the United States gone, and two Vietnams with a buffer zone, and international trade inside this buffer zone, that the course of the country's history would resort back to what it was in the 1950s? Up to 1963 with the terrorism, would it almost go back to, well, the North's, the way it can, it's not going to invade conventionally through this buffer zone, let's say, for example, but it would infiltrate South Vietnam just as it did in the 50s?
I think the police action necessary, you know, to maintain those the buffer zones and those the, you know, open house area, mm-hmm. would be feasible, because it would be a small area with a very limited number of people, and then the administration of those zones with the gradual, you know, phasing out of the military and the action, mm-hmm. It would be possible, you know, together with everybody, the French, the Chinese, Beijing and so on, to have an effective police action there, because it was mainly a problem of maintaining, you know, law and order.
Perhaps involving the United Nations.
Yeah, you see, and then you have everybody committed, you know, to make the whole thing work on a very small area to begin with, as a test of your goodwill or not, you see. And of course, you have to bring in your, you know, military umbrellas to dissuade people not to do those bad things on both sides. And even then, you see, you can retaliate, you know. And that was amazing for me, that while North Vietnam claimed that it had the right, you know, to liberate the South, we never heard the South Vietnamese claiming the right to liberate the North.
Okay.
You see, because of the American policy, they couldn't do that, you see. They tried to do it with the commandos and so on that they threw over North Vietnam in the late 50s and the beginning of the 60s, but that stopped very quickly because it was no use, you know, for them to do it in such a way. You know, with the communist regime in North Vietnam, you don't infiltrate, you know, commandos.
Right. Well, would your buffer zone be kind of a small step into infiltrating the North through capitalism, letting the people see the benefits of free trade?
Well, by the end of the day, that would be, you know, the aim of it. But I think that Ho Chi Minh was not stupid enough not to see that it would be a good thing for him to, you know, to have more goods.
Right.
To use.
But he's dead, and so his successors...
Even then, you see, he had the idea of maintaining some autonomy for the south of Vietnam. That is, when he died in 1969, there was a meeting before his death of all the South Vietnamese cadres who went north in the 1940s, and even among them were my own uncles. Mm-hmm. And they reported, and they told me after 75 that they attended a meeting with Ho Chi Minh, who gathered all those South Vietnamese who joined him in the late 1940s in the north, in the Viet Minh ranks, to fight the French at that time, because they were all fighting together against the French return. Mm-hmm. And Ho Chi Minh did say that they were going to liberate South Vietnam, you see, sooner or later, but they must remember that the people in South Vietnam had lots of initiative and dynamic forces there for economic development and so on. And so they should maintain a kind of autonomy, you know, and let those Savians continue. Because he also mentioned that there were lots of accumulated assets left by the Americans in South Vietnam, you know, factories, all kinds mm-hmm. of machinery and so on and so forth, which later on we were able to assess in the order of about $20 billion, you know, because Vietnam in the early 1970s were even more ahead of South Korea and Thailand and so on economically. And even after the fall of Saigon in 1975, the communist administration there didn't know what to do with those machinery and factories and so on. And eventually, by the end of 1970s and beginning 1980s, they sold it as scraps mm-hmm. to everybody.
Do you see that as a softening of Ho Chi Minh's position before his death in the late
60s? No, you know, Ho Chi Minh, you can say whatever you want against him, but to me, he was a very practical man. And he was able to seize opportunities. And then he was able to play, you know, with everybody. Mm-hmm. You know? He's not a very original guy, but he was a great manipulator, you know. And he saw the little things that you could do in order to overcome the obstacles. I think that was the great, you know, ability mm-hmm. of Ho Chi Minh.
So, if you're in Paris now, today, 30 years later, and you're talking about this stuff, what's the reaction of the NLF side, Madame Ben is going to be there? What's the reaction that you think you would get?
Well, Larry Bellman will be there. Mm-hmm. So, he's the only one to more or less try to bring out the meaning and the significance of the American intervention in Vietnam mm-hmm. in an objective way. Mm-hmm. And probably Ambassador Bùi Diệp, you know, who's very anti-communist, mm-hmm. He will take. But it would be interesting if I were there, mm-hmm. you know, and see Madam Minh again, because we have been facing, you know, each other for years there. I would ask her to explain, because I'm still not able to understand, you know, the position she took with the North Vietnamese the government of Hanoi. What was, what did they mean exactly by American aggression in Vietnam? You know? I don't think that the American the nation is a very imperialist. You know, a nation, of course, they want their ways of life mm-hmm. to be accepted and enjoyed by other peoples in the world, mm-hmm. but I don't think they force people to their ways of life. Mm-hmm. It is open to them to accept their ways of life or not, you know, as long as they don't bomb, you know, American embassies and things like that. Mm-hmm. But I think that it would be useful if Madam Binh now, you see, 30 years after the Paris Agreement, you know, try to explain very sincerely and honestly to the American and the Vietnamese people what she meant by American aggression.
Would she be able to? Would she even want to engage in that?
But they are a bit, reluctant to explain that now. Mm-hmm. Even in Vietnam, you know, you have very little mention of those things nowadays in Vietnam, 30 years later. And I would also very honestly, you know, said to her, I have nothing against their political ideas or ideology. The only thing which can't really is to improve the lot of the Vietnamese people. And they claim to, for 50 years, they fought the French and the Americans and so on and so forth. But they have always claimed to have a better system, to have better goals and better aims for the Vietnamese people. And in 30 years of peace, so-called peace, after the signing of Paris Agreement, they failed completely.
Is that something that you would bring up and say, look at, here's your system that's been in place for 30 years now, and it has failed. So something needs to change.
Well, the first thing is that the Vietnam Communist Party, even among themselves, you know, now they have a big dispute. That is to say, for the first time, those communist leaders in Hanoi were not even able to do their autocritique, as Aung San Suu Kyi taught them. If you did bad things, no, be honest enough to admit it. And even among the members of the Communist Party now in Vietnam, they criticize their leaders for, you know, the utter failure to recognize their mistake in the last 30 years. They still claim that, you know, they have always done their best.
Why are they reluctant to do this?
Because I think that the leaders now there are not the kind of a stature level of Ho Chi Minh.
Intellectual level?
Intellectual. You know, nothing compared to Ho Chi Minh or Trường Chinh or, you know, all those people 30 years ago. So I think what has happened to the Vietnamese people after the colonial period in the 1940s, including Ho Chi Minh, I would say, the Vietnamese nation has suffered for a profound crisis of leadership, and it is getting worse and worse right now.
What's the answer?
Well, we have a proverb in our Vietnamese culture and tradition, and that the heroes and savior of the nation will come out of the crisis. And so I think that it is the yin yang theory. When it goes down to you know, the bottom, it has to go up. There's no other way to do it. And probably someone will come out, but it would be, you know, a guy in his 40s now, I suppose.
Let's go back to 1975. You're getting ready to be quote unquote re-educated. This is May 1975, and you knew that you would have to report for the so-called 30 days. And I assume you thought you would be released after 30 days. Or did you have an inclination that that probably was not going to happen?
Well, it was rather difficult to have a choice there for me personally.
Of course.
First of all, the overwhelming, you know, concern that I had at that time was for my own parents. And I was, you know, determined to stay by their side, you know, whatever may happen.
Excuse me, did your uncles say, look, when you go away for 30 days, or when you go away, you know, we're part of the family, we'll take care of your parents?
Oh yes, that was very clear to us, you know, after the 30th of April 75, they all rushed to our house. And it was amazing. It was amazing. Because, you know, they went north in the late 1940s.
Right.
You know? They burned the old houses in our native village, you know, except for that and the main house of the ancestors, which was handed down to the eldest son, mm-hmm. you know, the main branch of the family, mm-hmm. which happened to be my father, and they built their own house and left, joined the Viet Minh ranks in North Vietnam in the late 1940s.
Were these your mother's brothers or your father's brothers?
Fathers.
Father's, see, brothers.
Fathers, because on my mother's side there was not many people, you know. And they came back in Saigon, and we were really happy, you know, to be reunited. Though we did nothing, anything political, and there was no notion of defeat or victory. It was just the family, because it was so important to us that at last, you know, after so many years, 30 years, you know, we are now openly together, openly, mm-hmm. because we were also able to see one another now and then, covertly, mm-hmm. you know.
Did you ever get to travel north to see them?
No. No, okay. It was not possible.
But they were able to come south,
yes.
occasionally to
yes.
see you.
Because they operated in the south, and, those relatives.
What were their positions in the Vietnam?
Well, the most striking guy was my the seventh uncle. We call the seventh uncle. He joined the Viet Minh ranks in the late 1940s. And by the time of the Geneva Accords in 1954, he also reached the rank of a colonel in the regular army in North Vietnam. And after that, he was sent to the Soviet Union, got training in economics mm-hmm. management, and returned to Hanoi to manage the state-owned enterprises there. And in the 1975, when Saigon fell, he was made a kind of the party secretary for the light industry. And he took over, for example, the mill factories and the can factories, you know, foodstuff, mm-hmm. which was very, very essential because, you know, that's the food problem too. And so, He was, shall we say, in the party, in the Communist Party, at the ministry level. He was the political commissar for the light industry. The ninth uncle, much more intellectual, he got a so-called PhD together with his wife from the Soviet Union. He was in Prague, Czechoslovakia, and then in Moscow, and returned. And became a kind of vice minister for education, and he was made the head of the UNESCO Vietnam chapter mm-hmm. After the fall of Saigon. So that was for the education. on the paternal side, we also had the Hai Tan, a kind of I would call a cousin of my father. Mm-hmm. You know. But I consider him as an uncle, because in the Vietnamese tradition, when you have the cousins mm-hmm. of your father, they are considered uncles, you see. That one is a three-star general, and he was the commanding general for the missile force of North Vietnam. And eventually he went to fight in Cambodia, you know, and in the 80s, after 79 return, and each week he visited my father. He was younger than my father, but they really love each other, you know, since childhood and so on and so forth. And it was a very sad thing of that you know, general, three-star general, you know. He got an operation for appendicitis mm-hmm. at the Thong Nhuc Hospital in Saigon, reserved for the big shots, mm-hmm. and he died from infection of that appendicitis. A three-star general would die from infection from, because it was really dirty in that hospital. Mm-hmm. And so that was his fate. And it is interesting also to mention that our native village on my father's side of Dong Trom in Ben Tre province, the whole province of Ben Tre, you know, that is the province of uprising, you have to call it. That is where all the resistance movement started against the French and so on. Mm-hmm. And it was called the uprising province. Uprising. Mm-hmm. You have fourteen generals, you know, Hanoi Viet Cong generals, 14, and 8 of them were from our native village of Yom Kau.
Wow.
And there was also a very well-known general by the name of German Kong, who grew up with my father. Mm-hmm. And he was, when he was a boy, he was responsible to take care of the buffaloes. Mm-hmm. And then he had to count the buffaloes after each day. Mm-hmm. in the fields. And he became also a three-star general. And that's from the Yom Trom village, my father's native village. Mm-hmm. And so almost, everybody in our extended family went Viet Cong, and only my father remained because he was responsible for the ancestors' altar and remained there and became, capitalist side. Mm-hmm. In the conflict.
By default, really, because he had to stay and take care of the ancestors.
Yeah, I think it was not much of a choice, and continue mm-hmm. with life like that.
Do you think he would have gone north if he had a choice? Do you think he would have gone to the
At that time, I mean, if, as most of the youngsters were very motivated, mm-hmm. in the 1940s after the Second World War, mm-hmm. and with the return of the French, because at the mm-hmm. beginning you had the British troops, you had the Indian troops, you had the Chinese troops, even before the French returned. Mm-hmm. And then the French returned. I think that most of the young people at that time were clearly motivated to fight against the return of the French colonial forces. Mm-hmm. There was no hesitation whatsoever, because we didn't see anything mm-hmm. Else. And then even when Ho Chi Minh formed his government and made the declaration of independence in September 2nd 1945, after that he did try, and again he's very crafty, you must admit the guy was really skillful. He tried and set up a kind of a coalition government, mm-hmm. Which was really, amazing, because, in other countries, the Communist Party, if they took power, they would not have coalition governments with anybody.
Right.
But in North Vietnam, Ho Chi Minh did that, mm-hmm. But he did that to serve his purpose, because he did not really, believe in any kind of power sharing or mm-hmm. political coalition mm-hmm. at all. And just a few months later, all those so-called coalition governments collapsed completely, because he started to eliminate mm-hmm. The opposition. Mm-hmm. See, so by the late 1940s, everybody knew very well that there was no way to compromise with the Vietnam Communist Party. And my uncles, through the conversation I had with them after the fall of Saigon, they were not communists at all. They happened to be there, to be in that side, and they just continued like that. Those who were in the army continued with the military career, those who were in the industry continued to be workers or managers, and like the ninth uncle, he was in education mm-hmm. and he pursued his career in education. So that was it.
In general, would you say that the Vietnamese people living in the north and some of the upper echelon people living in the north were really, truly communist, or were they simply there because that's where they lived? And did they have a political ideology? Did they really believe that they were communist? If you walked up to somebody in Vinh or outside of Hanoi and said, are you a communist? Privately.
Very honestly, I'm sure you also share my views. By the 1940s, I doubt very much that people were much aware of, ideological considerations mm-hmm. about capitalism and communism or socialism. Mm-hmm. It was just a matter of, I would say, nationalism. Mm-hmm. which was also a very vague feeling and concept.
Mm-hmm.
The only concrete and practical, the normalization of that kind of Southern nationalism would be to put an end to colonial rule and so-called feel that you are now independent or sovereign in your country, which were also, I'm sure, very vague ideas to national sovereignty and national independence.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the upsurge, a tremendous upsurge in all those former colonial countries.
Mm-hmm.
And so, talking to those uncles, I did not have an impression that they were communists at all, you see. And they accepted the leadership of the Vietnam Communist Party because there was no other kind of leadership
right.
available to them.
Mm-hmm.
And they never questioned it,
mm-hmm.
you see. Because the Vietnamese Communist Party at that time claimed to rid the colonial rule and bring back, some kind of dignity to the Vietnamese people. That was all, you see. And it was also somehow, shall we say, obvious to them that with massive American presence in South Vietnam, they continue with the same idea of getting rid of foreign rule in the country
mm-hmm.
without understanding anything else.
Mm-hmm.
You see,
mm-hmm.
that was a very simple thing.
Yes.
And that also went through the ordinary people in the countryside.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever you may say and claim and argue, you have to face a very sad reality, you know, and that the massive shelling, bombing by, you know, American bombs and American weapons, you see, on those very ordinary people, you see, prevent them from understanding any kind of ideological conflict.
Mm-hmm.
They were not able to understand that.
They simply wanted that bombing to stop.
To stop.
And they wanted
the as they would,
out.
You know, expect the communist Vietnamese to stop their assassination, their acts of terrorism, you know, in the villages and the hamlets.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you see, the communist cadres at the very grassroots levels, they work in very concrete details. That is to say, when they perpetrated their terrorist acts, they did it very precisely on individuals
mm-hmm.
whom they claimed were traitors to the country.
Right.
You see. And that those people also commit horrible crimes against the people and so on and so forth. It was not blind terrorism. Not at all, you know. That is saying they didn't go in there and just spray, you know,
mm-hmm.
The offices of the Saigon people,
mm-hmm.
Saigon government people. And they assassinated people very specifically, claiming that those people were traitors to the nation.
Mm-hmm.
And so, the only people in the countryside did not have any choice at all. And I still hope that they did not make any choice. They just accept the situation. That is to say, it was an impossible choice, you know, for them to choose the American way or the communist way. But in the end, by the end of the day, if you force them through your dialectic of terror to make a choice, then we go Viet Cong instead of American.
Because it's Viet Cong is Vietnamese.
Yeah.
And American is
that
American.
Is to say, if I had to be killed, even, or my family to be killed, it probably much better to be killed by Vietnamese than by an American.
Mm-hmm.
So probably that is, you know, by the end of the day, you know, what they have to accept.
Mm-hmm.
And it was no choice.
Mm-hmm.
Not of much of a choice.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that the main calamity of the Vietnamese people since the 1940s was that they were never given a choice. They never had that opportunity to have a say, because it was, I don't know how, that you could have the will of the people in those years, mm-hmm. of the 1940s and 50s. The notion of democracy and freedom, you know, political liberties, were just, you know, beginning to come to the people. And I say here a horrible thing, but I don't believe that whatever elections that you could have held in North or South Vietnam in the 1940s or 1950s or 1960s were much meaningful to the large mass of the Ombi people. Because you never had elections in the history of the Vietnamese nation. You know, the Chinese or even the Southeast Asian countries in their 4,000 years of history never had elections.
Are the Vietnamese people today capable of making a choice if they were given free elections? Would they understand? Would they be able to make that leap?
After 30 years now since the signing of the Paris Agreement, they are now beginning to understand what you mean by elections, you see. But then, you see, you have to bring down real democracy to the grassroots. If you continue to have the Vietnamese Communist Party running the lives of the people from the hamlets, villages up to the National Assembly, then I don't believe much in those elections.
Right.
And it is much more, I think, in the ability of the ordinary people in the villages or the hamlets to get a better living standard in order to really appreciate what the political liberties mean. Because when you hardly have enough to eat, you know, and you ask people to make political choices, that wouldn't mean much. It's still a long way to go.
Okay, so let's talk about your initial days of going into re-education. And I had asked you about, did you really think that it was going to last 30 days? How realistic was that to you?
Well, to begin with, it was a very, you know, difficult period just after the fall of Saigon, the days following the fall of Saigon, because I'm sure that no one had a very clear idea what would happen, even to the general population. And then we realized that except for the presence of the North Vietnamese troops and the Soviet tanks, the administration of the town was not very clear. We were told then, right afterwards, that it was put under military rule, and the three-star general, Trần Văn Trà, who was the commanding general of the Viet Cong forces, and who was, of course, in the commanding generals, among the commanding generals of the North Vietnamese troops. Except for the presence of those North Vietnamese troops, who were very young, you know, in their late teens, that was probably also true with the large majority of the American troops. In South Vietnam, they were in their late teens too. And we were told that the Saigon, Jiading, metropolitan area would be put under military rule of General Trần Văn Trà. But there was nothing else. So we were completely in the dark what we were supposed to do. And so during those, during the whole week, I would say after the fall of Saigon, with the reunion in the family, with the uncles and all other relatives, I was able to circulate very freely went about the town and took the uncles and the other relatives for a tour, because they were really astonished by the standard of living, by the buildings and the cars. You know, they didn't see so many cars in their whole lives. And we were waiting to see what we were supposed to do. And I personally was very aware that some kind of retaliation would be, taken against the former high-ranking officials of the Saigon government.
What did you expect to happen to you?
Well, to begin with, to be arrested, because there were also a few arrests in Saigon, but it was just isolated situation in the various precincts. But it was not widespread. We did not have a scene of people, being arrested or taken to the wall or something at trees. I was told later that in some, remote areas in South Vietnam, there were some of those exactions, but in Saigon it did not happen. And we just waited to see what were required. I was mainly concerned for the safety of my parents, not because they did anything, bad in their lives, but my presence in the family house would be a danger to them. So that was it. So when it was decreed that all the high-ranking officials of the former Saigon regime would have to report for re-education, for a period of 30 days. So the first reaction I had was that, well, I don't think that in my case it would be 30 days. Maybe, the lower ranking official, that would be 30 days. But I waited to see whether there were additional instructions, for the higher ranking officials of the Saigon government. But there was none. So we were put all in the same boat, if I may say so. That is to say, anybody above the rank of the chief of service, that is to say, you may have a directorate, a director, and right under him, you would have various services. And if you are at the head of a service, then you have to report for that 30-day re-education. And in the Saigon administration, you have the ministry, and then after that you have the directorate general, and after the directorate general you have the directorates, and after the directorates you have the service. So that way. And in the army, that would be the second lieutenant up. So that was. And my uncles then said to me, "Oh yeah, that would be a good thing for you to go, for that 30-day re-education period. Then you would learn, much more about our side." That was the expression they used.
They
did not say communist side or non-communist side or puppets and the nationalists. But in our discussion in family, we always use the expression "my side, your side."
Did they know that, or have any inclination that it would last longer than 30 days for you?
They didn't give me that impression at all. Okay. I think they also believe it themselves. You see, and in fact, later on, we will find out that Jean Tramonta, the South Vietnamese general, sincerely put out those 30 days. But then it did not exclude that some special cases may have other special treatment. But he was sincere, because by the end of that period of 30 days, there were a convoy of trucks, army trucks, mm-hmm. coming from Saigon to our camp to bring us back home. But then on the way, it received instructions to turn back. So I don't know whether it was a show or not, but that was what the general population saw, okay. You see. And I was told later on that it was really, you know, the intention of Jean Chan to have those 30 days of education for those people with the understanding that special cases would receive special treatment. Mm-hmm. But that was his idea. Mm-hmm. And as we know, eventually Jean Chan was in big disagreement with the North Vietnamese officials, mm-hmm. and was sacked from his position. Mm-hmm. Later, he wrote a book on the victory of the revolutionaries taking Saigon, and the book circulated a few days and was confiscated completely and withdrawn from circulation. Mm-hmm. And I was told that he was even under some kind of a house arrest.
Really?
And that what happened also to many of those so-called Viet Cong officials,
mm-hmm.
The South Vietnamese,
yes.
People in the ranks of the NLF. Because as soon as the North Vietnamese officials came down to take over, you know, the administration of Saigon, of South Vietnam, most of those South Vietnamese were, you know, put aside. That was the beginning of the big clean-up. Mm-hmm. But then we were sent to that rallying point a long time, which the place used to be an orphanage.
Long time orphanage.
Yes, orphanage. And we were about 3,000 there. Mm-hmm. And
could you bring anything with you?
Yes, very little things, mm-hmm. you know, for 30 days. Mm-hmm. And then a little bit of pocket money too. But then it was, you know, rapidly discovered by the families where we were. It was not difficult to find out that. And so members of family flocked to the orphanage trying to get in to have visits, but were not allowed. Mm-hmm. But they did allow to send in letters and some money to pass to the inmates. Mm-hmm. And we were kept there exactly for 30 days.
Okay. Yeah. What were your living conditions like there?
Oh, well, it was very primitive. It was completely empty. The orphanage was completely empty, no furniture whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
And there were, you know, buildings with aluminum sheets, roofing, and it was just tiles,
mm-hmm.
very primitive tiles as a floor. We slept on the floor. And the food was provided twice a day, lunch and dinner, by the administration. Very primitive too, but we had rice.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there was no shortage of rice in Saigon. And it was amazing too, because just after the fall of Saigon, there was no disruption in power, electricity, and you know, the utilities, and everything went very normal. Because all the whole machinery of the Saigon administration continue to function,
mm-hmm.
for those things.
Mm-hmm. Did you know anybody there with you in at Long Thanh?
Oh, I was able to recognize about a dozen whom I met before,
mm-hmm.
but the rest I didn't know at all, although everybody seemed to know me. Because I must say that since 1968 I went to Paris and were no longer in Saigon, returned only occasionally for a few days each time, and did not know you know, many people, mm-hmm. In the Saigon administration later.
Mm-hmm. Who in your family visited you?
No one. I think the kids were at the gates to bring in letters and some money. And there was a canteen that you can buy noodles, you know, instant noodles and sugar, coffee and things like that.
Did you purchase some?
Oh, yes. Okay. Because I couldn't eat there, the kind of cooking. And so I bought a lot of those instant noodles, which was easier to eat.
How much did you weigh when you first went into Longtan?
150 something pounds.
Okay.
I think I was about 72 kilos when I left Paris.
Okay.
So but then afterwards, one morning we were designated by name to take our bags and packages and get on a truck, an army truck. So there was a small convoy there, and we were about 100 to be gathered there that morning, and we were taken to the Tulip prison, real prison, because in Saigon there were two large prisons, Chiwa prison, right inside the town, and the city, and the other one at the suburb. Outside on the Tudor suburb, and we were taken there, 100 of us.
What did you feel when you realized 30 days were up and you weren't going home?
We were really deceived, but I was not surprised because I was thought that in my case, you know, there would be some special treatment. And so when I was taken to the Tuduk prison, it was more or less what I had expected. So I just waited to see what's next.
Were you very talkative? Did you talk a lot?
Not at all.
Not at all?
Well, they didn't ask anything during the 30-day period in Longtan, orphanage. We were free to move around together, day and night, and it was kind of a picnic.
Did you talk to your fellow prisoners very much?
Not much, because I didn't know them. And the few that I recognized there, and didn't talk to.
Okay. So, Tuduk, this is a conventional prison?
Yes, a former prison.
And
very well known, too.
What kind of conditions were there?
You were put in cells.
Private cell or with?
I was put in a cell, probably the cream of the cream, as the French say. We were about 20 in that cell.
How big was the cell?
I would say that would be about 6 meters wide and 15 meters long. No windows whatsoever.
Big, 6 by 15.
Yeah.
Okay.
A big iron door. And then you have openings at the ceiling. Very wide opening for the air and the light to come in.
Was there a screen, or could you see the stars and the sun, the sky?
Well, I think the roof was overlapping. Okay. The walls outside, so we couldn't see much of the sky, but there was the light coming in and the air coming in. Because no air conditioning or fans or any sort.
Very hot.
Yeah, and very hot. And then in the early morning, by 5 a.m., that's waking time, we were taken to to the so-called bathroom. And then to have our toilet there.
What was that like?
Oh, it was just, you know, how would you say it? Lots of those water taps, series of them. And you just use them collectively. And afterwards, we would have a small walk in the courtyard and then back into the cell.
How long were you outside the cell?
Oh, probably half an hour, and half an hour of you know, freshen up in the morning, so it would be by an hour back into the cell again.
Any
then
breakfast?
In the evening, they would allow us to go out for another hour like that, go to the bathroom and so on.
Okay.
And at lunchtime, the door would be open, and then we would have the possibility to go out in the courtyard to eat.
How many meals did you have?
Twice a day.
No breakfast, just lunch and...
No breakfast. There, at the Tunduk, there was no breakfast.
So you woke up very hungry every morning?
Yeah, we just wait for lunch. It's okay.
Okay.
I don't usually have breakfast anymore.
Okay. Was there any...
But many of them brought their own things, you know, they still have a few things there. And there was also the possibility to get help from the guards to buy things, you know, cigarettes and sugar and...
How would you do that?
You just ask the guards, give him the money. Mm-hmm. They were quite friendly.
Really?
Yeah, they were quite friendly.
Were these...
Very courteous and friendly.
These NVA troops or...?
No, South Vietnamese.
South Vietnamese guarding South Vietnamese.
Yeah.
Interesting. What kind of so-called re-education went on at Tu Duc?
There was nothing at all.
No political talks?
Strictly nothing at the Long Thanh Orphanage. And then in the Tu Duc prison, the only thing we had was, listening to the radio to a very strong loudspeaker.
In the camp, outside?
In the camp, in the whole prison.
Uh-huh.
That was it. Was there any reading of the newspaper? I can't remember. In the Tu Duc prison, we had even reading of newspapers.
What about any conversations with your fellow inmates?
Very little. Mm-hmm. Because I think everybody was a bit cautious, you know, not to say bad things and so on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it impressed me very much because from the first time I met acquaintance with lots of people whom I didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
And in my cell, there were mainly high officials from the police, high officials from the Central Intelligence Office, and then a few cabinet ministers whom I didn't know at all, because I didn't meet them before, and some political leaders. And there was an amazing case there of a grand old man, white hair, white beard, you know, Uncle Holstein.
Mm-hmm.
He was in his 70s. And that was Yu Hong Khan, who was the honorary chairman of the Quốc dân Đảng Party, kind of Kuomintang Party. And he was a kind of, even a kind of deputy prime minister with Ho Chi Minh in 1945 in Hanoi.
Mm.
And he was even the boss of General Giap for defense when Ho Chi Minh tried to get some so-called coalition with the nationalist parties,
mm-hmm.
The traditional patriotic parties. And he was there with me in that cell. Later on, I was told that because of his age, and also when you open the history books used at the high schools in North Vietnam, you have lots of his photos,
mm-hmm.
with Ho Chi Minh,
mm-hmm.
During the what they call the September Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
But then he went really anti-communist, had a bloody fight with the Communist Party.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, I was told that he was allowed to go back to his village in North Vietnam under house arrest and die there eventually.
Did you speak with him much?
Oh, yes. He liked very much to have a conversation with me in the evening.
He knew who you were?
Yes, mm-hmm. And he was not very keen to talk to anybody else, but he accepted, you know, to sit down with me in the evening, and then we talked about you know, all kinds of things. He wanted to know, you know, what happened in Paris and during my days in England and things like that. Mm-hmm. Very nice man.
How long would you talk in the evenings?
Oh, an hour or two.
Mm-hmm. Is this after you've eaten and gone back into the cell? Or was it when you were outside?
After being locked up in the cell. Because by 5 p.m., according to law, we must be locked up in the cell. Okay. There was also other interesting people there. There was a colonel of the Saigon Army. Mm-hmm. I happened to know him very occasionally before, and he was made at one time the head of our Central Intelligence Office, that is the Vietnamese CIA, the Saigon CIA. Mm-hmm. And so he was the director of our CIA. Mm-hmm. And that was the time of General Nguyen Khanh, when General Nguyen Khanh took power from Big Minh. Mm-hmm. He was made the head of the intelligence, Saigon Intelligence Agency. And afterwards, he was put in Phnom Penh as military attaché, something. And he was made responsible to spy or get intelligence from the what they call the base R, which is the headquarters of the Viet Cong, mm-hmm. near the Thai and Cambodian border. Mm-hmm. It turned out he was in the same cell there as the former head of our CIA. But he also had an elder sister who was also a colonel of the Hanoi Army intelligence.
Really?
A colonel too. And then I found out through conversation with him during that period together in the same cell at the Thu Duc prison, and that many of the Viet Cong leaders, like Trần Văn Đăng, at the level of you know, Lawyer Nguyễn Hữu Thọ and Trần Đình Thảo and so on, those Viet Cong leaders or NNF leaders very often visited Saigon. Mm-hmm. You know, when he was the head of our intelligence agency. And most of them stayed at his house.
At his what?
At his house.
Really?
Yeah. So I was really surprised to learn those things.
Uh-huh. How long were you there?
I can't remember exactly, but I think we were there probably 2 months or something.
How did you feel being locked up in a prison cell? I mean, you
were first time. Not my first experience with the prison. But that was really bad. Really bad, not because of the physical conditions, but it was very bad because nobody told you anything. You know, what would happen to you? Would you stay here for a long time or not? Or would you be you know, taken to court to be a judge or something. Mm-hmm. So there was nothing at all. Completely nothing at all. You see. And the guards were quite friendly too. Mm-hmm. You know, we didn't have bad guards, not at all. Probably because, you know, mainly because we were such a special group to begin with. There was only one female.
In the cell with you?
That group of about 100.
Okay.
She was put at the very back of the prison by herself. And her name was Thuy, T-S-U-Y. Mm-hmm. And I was told that she was the head of what was called the Squang Brigade. Mm-hmm. In the intelligence service, she was responsible for recruiting, training, and using female spies mm-hmm. in espionage and counter-espionage.
Mm-hmm.
And she was the head of the Swan squad, the mm-hmm. Golden Swan squad. I think she took, in the end, more than 10 years of prison.
Really?
And eventually was allowed to go to the States, and still lives in the States now.
Really?
Running a kind of a shop or something. And I think she's calling her shop the Swan shop. In memory of her past.
Her old squad.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you were not given any information about what might happen to you. And your 30 days obviously were up before. Now you're there for another 60 days or so. How did you have any link at all to the outside? Did any of your family members ever stood
you? Nothing at all.
Nothing.
Nothing. It was, you know, they didn't know where we were. And of course they learned from the long time of Finnish people there that about 100 of us were taken somewhere,
mm-hmm.
but we didn't know where. They didn't know where.
They might have thought that you were killed or dead, or did they?
Of course, at home they were very worried.
Right.
You see, if only I could, you know, pass the word that I was all right and so on, but there was no way, you know. And it was really, you know, probably the hardest part of the whole story. You know, even afterwards when I was sent in North Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
it was not that bad. Because those few weeks at the Thu Duc prison, you know, was really mentally was unbearable. For not knowing,
mm-hmm.
that's all.
Right.
If I were told what would happen to us, okay.
Right.
But I was also worried for the people at home, but from the guards that we talked to in the Thu Duc prison, we had the general impression that life continued, you know, normally in Saigon City.
Mm-hmm.
There was nothing drastic mm-hmm. happening to the people there. And I was hopefully thinking that, you know, my own parents and the family there would be all right, because they haven't done anything bad.
Mm-hmm. What kind of influence did your uncles have upon your imprisonment?
Nothing at all.
Really?
And that is the that's the rule, even now, you know, that they don't intervene. But then later on, when I was in the North Vietnam, I was informed very officially, you know, one Sunday, I remember, by I think a kind of a vice minister
mm-hmm.
of the responsible for security
mm-hmm.
came down to see me and told me then that a total of 18 relatives, high ranking, you know, of the Hanoi administration had signed a petition vouching for me, asking me to be released in their custody.
Mm-hmm.
You know. And that vice minister came down and laughingly, you know, said that the party in the government regretted very much, but could not give satisfaction to the petition. And so I also jumped back to, you know, at that time I was really skinny.
Mm-hmm.
And I said that, you know, with the weight I have now, how come that I, you know, am much heavier than the 18 relatives? So we had a good laugh, that's all.
How did you deal with that mentally at Thu Duc? What did you do inside your head? How did you deal with that?
I can't remember how I managed to go through that very hard period. But it was really mental torn. Very, very hard there. And then I remember another Vietnamese saying, you know, that better death than separation.
Mm-hmm.
Really had that thing. But it was really bad. Really bad.
Did you remain hopeful that something would come out of this?
Oh yes, always. You know, there's still always a little bit of hope somewhere. But I was really worried for the family. Mm-hmm. That was the main problem. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, nothing would prevent them to take, you know, have action against my members of my family.
Mm-hmm. Did you consider death?
Oh, yes. Yes.
How so?
Well, because I expected always the worst from the communist side.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe they would be kicked out of the house, put in the street, they confiscated all their belongings and things like that. I thought of all kinds of things. And
For your family, right?
Yeah.
What about for yourself?
Oh, for myself, I didn't think much for myself, really.
You didn't think that you would be executed?
Well, all those things passed through my mind.
Right.
But the attitude I had at that time about my old self, I mean, I would only, you know, want to be told what would happen to me. That's all. I was always prepared to accept anything if only I were told. You know.
But since you weren't told.
So, I wasn't told, you know, that it was a guessing game. The worst of the worst, you know, to be executed or to be locked up for the rest of your life. But it seems that, you know, my torment was much more or not being told.
Right. Right.
And I even, you know, thought at one time that those guys, you know, intentionally, you know, adopted that kind of game to make you suffer.
Do you think they did that?
I'm not telling you.
Do you think it was intentional?
I thought that way. Mm-hmm. But I don't know.
Did you contemplate suicide?
Oh, no.
No?
No.
Why not?
I don't know, it was not in the tradition of the family to do things like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I have always been against those things.
Do you remember what they broadcast over the loudspeakers in the camp? What kind of message they were trying to send to you? What were they saying?
I think that they carried the communist lines.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, you know, they liberated the country and then they chased the imperialists out. And the puppet administration collapsed and things like that. Yeah. That was the theme.
How did your fellow inmates react to that kind of
message? We didn't even want to listen to it.
Right.
You know, when we have those radio programs, we thought of something else, and then we try and go on mm-hmm. with you know, something mm-hmm. in the cell.
Right. Was there any kind of leadership developed within your cell and
no,
within the camp?
Not at all. Not at all. Nobody wanted to be the leader of anything anymore.
I want to ask this question now, and I want to ask it later, but you seem to have a very good sense of humor about this very tragic experience in your life. How is that?
Well, probably my British humor. acquiring my stay in England.
Mm-hmm.
But that was a way for me also to calm myself down. Because, you know, jokes always pop into my head all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I tried to make use of those things.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end it became a kind of a second state of mind throughout the whole, you know, those years in prison.
Mm-hmm. Did you talk into yourself, or would you tell jokes to the people in the cell with you?
Mostly to myself, but sometimes I also pass the joke to others, you know, and mm-hmm. try and make them laugh too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Were you successful?
Sometimes, because it was a bit, you know, a kind of black humor.
Mm-hmm.
For example, we hardly have meat mm-hmm. when we were in prison in North Vietnam, because even the ordinary people in the villages didn't have meat.
Mm-hmm.
And we may have rice and meat on only four occasions in the year. That is for Tet, for Labor Day, mm-hmm. For the National Day, mm-hmm. and then the Christmas and the New Year. And it was really funny because the amount of meat that we receive with the little bit of rice, not half a bowl of rice, but that's for big occasions, you know, right. those four major holidays of the year. And we were divided in groups of 10 for our meal, mm-hmm. because the soup would be there for 10 people, the rice would be there to be divided by, for 10 people.
This is in North Vietnam?
In North Vietnam. Okay. And the piece of meat, I can say to you, literally, you know, which was in the kind of soup, you know, then you fish it out, and then it's called meat, because you are supposed to have meat on those big occasions. And for a group of 10, the piece of meat would be as big as your toe, you know, for 10 people. A finger, a thumb, mm-hmm. and then we had to divide in 10 equal pieces, you know. And then the joke we had there was the hand of a lizard.
The hand of a lizard?
Yeah, that's your share of meat. The hand of the lizard, that is the Vietnamese expression. Uh-huh. You know? Not a big one.
Would you all laugh at that? I mean, that
oh, yes. Oh, and then we had also incident, because I was in a group of 10, and for unknown reasons I was put up among the very old people, mm-hmm. in their 60s and 70s. Mm-hmm. You know.
But you were in your 40s.
I was not even barely in my 40s.
Right.
And then there were two very old guys, mm-hmm. who were in their 70s. Mm-hmm. You know. One was Tam Hu, and he was a horse cart driver all his life, completely illiterate, in the Gokong province, in a small village there. And we found ourselves in the cell with him, and we were very surprised that, you know, an illiterate horse cart driver, you know, to be there with us. And we at the beginning did not ask him why he was sent there for education at that age and so on. But he was a kind, nice guy. And there was another one, a political leader of a political party, who was in his, 70s also. All those two guys, you know, fought each other all the time.
Really?
They got into rows and stuff. And then, at one time, when we had those hands of the lizard, you know, mm-hmm. divided among us, the poor horse cart driver was not looking. You know, at his piece of meat, mm-hmm. he looked out at the outside the window. The other old guy took the hand of the lizard of the horse car driver and ate it. So, a split of a second later, the horse car driver said, "What happened to my hand of the lizard? Where is it?" And they had a fight too.
Really, a physical fight?
Yeah, physical fight. Because he suspected the other guy only. There was no one there who would, you know, take his...
No one would say what happened?
And then they went out into the courtyard and began to fight. But they were so old that, you know, neither of them managed to hit the other and fell on the crown. Each time he tried to punch the other one, fell on the crown. And that was a kind of a spectacle that we had to,
right,
you know,
sure.
As entertainment. And the living conditions were very hard. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So from the Thủ Đức prison, you know, one morning very early, by 5 in the morning, we were called into the courtyard. Mm-hmm. And then we were chained 2 by 2.
So I was at your ankle or
no,
hand?
No, a hand.
Okay.
And with chains, because they did not have how do you call that?
Handcuffs.
And they cut little pieces of chains and they put us together. I was put together with a congressman, member of the National Assembly, mm-hmm. of Saigon, mm-hmm. who was a lawyer and then joined him to become one of those the members of the National Assembly. And they use a kind of a lock. to lock us two by two there. And I was even able to pull a joke when we were put two by two there, chained together.
Mm-hmm.
I said to the guard, "And what happened if we went to tea?"
Yeah.
The guard said, "Don't worry, I'll be there. I'll lock you to go to tea."
Uh-huh.
Okay, that's what happened that very early morning.
Uh-huh.
And we were taken from the Tuduk prison in army trucks again to the airport, the Singapore airport. And we were put on the C-130 plane.
How many people with you?
The 100.
The whole 100. Okay.
The whole 100. Okay. And then took off.
Mm-hmm.
We all said, "Well, we are going to the Gongdao prison. That's a very famous French, old French prison." But then, after about half an hour, we realized that we were going north.
How did you feel?
I didn't feel anything in particular. Okay, we were taken to North Vietnam. So
but you knew this meant, you must have known that this meant you were not going home.
Yes, I didn't expect to go home anyway.
Really?
You know, we didn't expect, because there was no indication or sign of any sort that we would be released. We were just curious, and we wanted really to know what's next, that's all.
Mm-hmm.
And it was no surprise to me that we were going north.
The guards wouldn't tell you anything?
They didn't know even themselves,
really?
They realized. You see, there were about two or three of them in the plane with that, you know, the C-130
mm-hmm.
opened up at the,
mm-hmm.
the back. And then with that kind of plane, as soon as you get up before takeoff, you see you have lots of steam coming out and things. Mm-hmm. I didn't see anything. And in a way, I was personally, you know, relieved and, that we were not going to the Gongdao prison.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you go there, you know, you hardly get out of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's an island, as you
yes.
know. So when we landed in the Nội Bài, Jhelum Airport, you know, that was the military airport of Hanoi. We discovered also that the plane was flown by former Saigon Air Force pilots.
Really?
You know? And then they were put into the army trucks with us to go to the re-education camp.
Oh, gosh.
And so we had a big laugh. I mean, I even said to one of them, "You know, you need only about 2 or 3 degrees to arrive in the Philippines." Nobody would know.
Right.
And then we even joke, say even the guards would be very happy.
Why do you think they...
They didn't think of it.
They didn't think of it.
Yeah, they didn't think of it. My God. And so those Saigon Air Force pilots, you know, joined me in the re-education camp.
Mm.
Because they were the ones who were able to fly those planes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The North Vietnamese would know how to fly those C-130s.
Were these American C-130s left over?
Yeah.
From the war?
Yeah.
Took you to prison in Hanoi,
yeah.
Flown by South Vietnamese Air Force
yeah.
pilots.
Yeah.
That's amazing. When you got off the plane...
We were put in army trucks again.
Could you tell a difference between geography, just kind of the climate, or was it?
Oh yes, it was North Vietnam, as you know, it was completely different from
right.
South Vietnam.
Right.
I had that impression right away.
Had you been there before?
No, never. You see, and most of us never had the opportunity to go to North Vietnam, except the few North Vietnamese who went down south in 1955
right.
at the partition of the country.
Right.
And many of them were very moved to be back in Hanoi, because we went through the city of Hanoi.
You drove through Hanoi?
You have through the city of Hanoi to get out again to the countryside roads and go to Hà Tây, you know,
right.
about 30 miles from there.
What did Hanoi look like?
Oh, it was bad. To us, coming from Saigon,
yes.
and the Saigon we knew, it was really terrible.
Yeah.
Dirty, broken down houses and things like that. And there were, you know, very drab people in the streets, and no, not many cars, and the few cars would be from the Soviet, you
mm-hmm.
know, thing. It was terrible.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And that was no surprise to us.
Right.
I mean, to us, the southerners.
Had it been rebuilt from some of the bomb damage?
No, we didn't see any anything rebuilt at all.
You did see some ruins, or not?
During the trip, no.
Okay.
They go. Because, in fact, there were only a few places destroyed in Hanoi. It was not widespread at all.
Just in the center by the railway station.
And so we went through, and some of the kids threw rocks at us, and insults and so on. Little kids.
They
disturbed many people.
They knew it was.
Oh yes,
who it was.
You can see right away, and we were still chained, two by two.
Right. Was the truck open in the back?
Yes, open completely. You know, but in Saigon, when we were moved, we had the badges off. But then it took us about a couple of hours to arrive at the camp, which was considered the number one camp in North Vietnam. That was the A-15 number camp. A-15, and it was called the Ha Tay camp because it belonged to the Ha Tay village. And we were put in the courtyard, sitting there, still chained two by two. And then the guards began to unlock. And then when it arrived to me and that the member of the National Day, they couldn't find the key.
Really?
And then everybody went in to the barracks, and we were just the two of us there, still sitting in the courtyard, and couldn't find the key. The guy forgot to bring the key or something, because you just pushed the lock, and that's all. And so we had to wait for him to go and get a saw.
Gosh.
And then so we managed in the end to free ourselves and get into the building. But I was assigned to the only brick building, because there were about a dozen of those buildings, but there was only one brick building, you know, and that was a brick building, and was used to have American prisoners of war there in 1973. So that building would house about 100 people.
How big was this camp, would you say, overall?
Oh, it's a big camp, because we have, you know, each building you can house about 100.
Okay.
100. And in the area where we were allowed to circulate, there were about a dozen of those buildings. But the one I was designated to occupy was the only brick building. All the others were, you know, kind of a touch, hay mud type of walls.
What was the inside of your brick building like? Was it divided into a number of cells?
No, it was just a common room with bunks, wooden bunks. And then at the one end, there was the toilets, about four of them, above ground, with a hole in it, that's it. And there was nothing else, but there were windows with bars and double bunks. So I was given one below with a chap on top of me, who was about 80 centimeters wide and about 2 meters long. That's our living space. But it was a big change, because it was on wooden,
right?
You know,
the mattress.
Yes, compared to the concrete bunks that we had into the prison.
Right.
Yeah.
So did you have a mattress?
No, it's kind of a straw mat.
A straw mat.
Yeah.
Okay.
Never a mattress.
Okay. Yeah. Any running water?
No, no water whatsoever in the cell.
Okay. Okay.
And outside too, and so we had to get our water from a kind of a pond.
A pond?
Yeah, a pond. And you use everything in that pond. You wash your clothes, you wash yourself.
And your water. Was it purified after you?
Oh, no.
For your drinking?
And we drank only the water from the kitchen, the boiling water from the kitchen, and it was given to us. The kind in form of kind of what they call the tea, reddish color liquid, boiled in a kind of leaves, you know, to replace tea. And so we were very careful to drink only that water.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. How many guards were there in this building?
I don't know exactly the whole total number of the guards there, because there were different areas.
Mm-hmm.
The generals and the high-ranking officers of the Second Army were put in a separate mm-hmm. area with high walls.
Okay.
We knew that they were on the other side,
mm-hmm.
but we were not allowed to communicate or to go to the other side. And now then we saw them, you know, working in the fields and mm-hmm. so on. But the military were put, the high-ranking military were put there. And we on the other side, so-called civilians.
Mm-hmm.
And there were about 1,200 of us, the whole camp. The number of guards, I would guess that it would be something like 30 to 50 people,
mm-hmm.
including the patrol guards.
Really?
Yeah. It was put under a major.
Were they in uniform?
They were in uniform.
What kind of weapons did they carry?
No weapons.
No weapons?
They didn't carry any weapons except for the patrol guards.
Outside?
Then they have their AK-47.
Uh-huh. Any guard towers?
No towers. No towers. Just high walls.
Mm-hmm.
But big entrance gates.
Mm-hmm.
You have the guards there.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the patrol outside the walls.
Right.
And they were armed. But inside the prison, they had no arms at all.
What was the terrain like outside the prison? Was it mountainous? Was it a flat field
or
woods?
That part of Hatay is rather flat.
Mm-hmm.
And you have the villages outside,
okay.
the markets and so on, and the ordinary farmers, they were outside.
Okay.
So we were very near the population.
Was there any talk of escape initially, at the beginning?
I don't know, but there was no talk about it.
Okay.
And nobody dared to organize anything, or even organize ourselves. So each one for himself, and we just followed the instructions, that's all.
There was no organization
amongst
yourselves?
No organization whatsoever. But they imposed an organization. You know, the prison administration. They divided first of us. They divide us in group of 10 mm-hmm. for the meals,
right?
You see? And then for the cleaning, the course, and so on and so forth. The toilets cleaning and so on. So we work by group of 10,
mm-hmm.
and there was nothing to do at all for a whole first year. We were not told anything. We were not, you know, supposed to do anything. Just vegetate there.
You just stayed in this house all day?
Yeah. But they allow us to move in the courtyard.
How often?
Oh, the whole day long.
Oh,
and then
okay.
Just locked up at 5 p.m. till 5 a.m. But for the rest of the time, we were allowed to circulate and talk and meet and, you know.
All 1,200?
The civilian,
okay.
among the civilian, and then the military, we didn't know very much what happened to them.
Okay.
They were on the other side
okay.
of the war. So that was it for the whole year. We just listened to the radio through the loudspeaker,
mm.
and then the reading of the Nhân Dân newspaper, that is the official organ of the Vietnam Communist Party.
Mm-hmm.
The reading of the newspaper took place before the lights out in the evening.
They would read it over the loudspeaker?
Yeah, no, in each cell.
Okay.
They asked us to sit around and listen to one of us reading the newspaper. That's it. And then during the day, then you have the Radio Hanoi, you know, ring through the loudspeaker.
All day?
All day.
All day long?
Really, all day long.
Talking, songs, or?
All kinds, you know, music and then you know, political articles and so on.
What would they say?
The same thing all the time, you know, under the leadership of the Communist Party, you know, and then the liberation of the whole country.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't pay much attention to
really?
It was just noise.
So it never effectively brainwashed or affected anybody significantly? Any of the
Nothing
prisoners?
At all.
Really?
You didn't even have any, lectures and conferences. They were not organized yet. We had the impression they didn't know what to do.
Really?
I think probably among themselves. Maybe they wanted to try us, or, exploit us,
mm-hmm.
or, do something. But I think there was no clear decision.
Mm-hmm.
And it was only after a year that we began to have indoctrination sessions. But we were asked to write our self-confession.
Initially, the first year?
Yeah, during the first year. Occasionally, they come down and make us write.
What would they say to you?
They say, just write, what you did in the past with the Saigon government, and things like that.
So you wrote
they down? Also had the, they also gave us the impression that the more sincere, honest, and the more complete your confession, and that would reflect good on you, things like that. In other words, the more you admit that you have committed crimes against the nation and the people, and be the henchmen of the imperialist Americans and things like that. That was the impression we had.
What did you write?
I wrote about, 47 pages, I remember. And I said, well, I was in the government, I was with social welfare and labor. And then that eventually I was with Paris Peace Talks. And just very briefly, what happened at the Paris Peace Talks, we had the meetings weekly, and most of the things that we did there, we did together with the North Vietnamese and the NLF delegations. I said also that the officials of the government and of the NLF would know much more about those things than I do. So it was public to everybody,
mm-hmm.
and full stop.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a guy in our cell. He wrote more than 5,000 pages.
Really?
For months. He admitted all the crimes that he committed against the Vietnamese communists.
His so-called crimes, or actually were they?
He was a political leader of the Dai Viet or something,
mm-hmm.
one of the patriotic things. And so he tried to, as he claimed, he tried to remember the bloody fight that he had with the Vietnamese communists from the late 1940s,
mm.
and even owned the communists that he killed himself, things like that.
Really? Was this when they said for you guys to be honest and to be
and
more
then,
sincere?
He keep on saying that he's now very much conscious of all those crimes against the Vietnamese people and nation, so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And eventually, he was also made by the prison administration as one of the group leaders, mm-hmm. among the prisoners.
Why?
Because eventually, we were also divided. And when we organized the labor teams,
mm-hmm.
and so he was chosen to be one of those things. No prisons, you have that kind of system,
right?
And he was a kind of antenna to to report to the prison authorities what was happening, so on and so forth.
Did you all know that?
Well, we all know that, of course.
So you didn't tell him very much or talk to him very much?
He even invented things to report, you see. But even the prison authorities, because I eventually got on very good terms with the director of the prison, Major Jung, and I even joked to him one day, that chap,
mm-hmm.
He's doing a very good job for the world, he said. The Major Jung, the prison director, he told me nobody believes him anyway. But he was beaten up once, because when we arrived at that camp, there were about 50 former commandos of Saigon who were sent to North Vietnam, airborne, and to sabotage things in North Vietnam.
Right.
He was caught in late 50s, early 60s,
mm-hmm.
and he has been. They have been there for 18 years, about 15 of them.
Mm.
And so one day, that group of 15 got hold of the guy I mentioned and beat him up.
Really?
Yeah.
Mm. Why don't we take a break for today?
Okay.
And we'll pick up later.
Are we? So the fall of Saigon.
Yes. Today is February 7, 2003, and I'm continuing my oral history interview with Ambassador Phong. Sir, let's pick up with your stay in the re-education camp outside of Hanoi, in the north, and this is 1975. I was wondering if we could talk about what a typical day was like there for you. And I know it changed from time to time, but let's start with the morning. When would you get up in the morning and what would you do?
Well, first of all, right after the fall of Saigon on April the 30th, mm-hmm. 1975, we were then very, anxious, mm-hmm. Anguished, rather, what would happen to us?
Mm-hmm.
And then, as you know, a couple of weeks later, we were all put into the re-education camp.
Right.
So I was sent into that long-term orphanage. For 30 days,
mm-hmm.
as it was supposed to be. And then we were not released after the 30 mm-hmm. days. I was moved then with a small group, about 100 of what we say the dangerous cases, you know, the high officials of the police,
mm-hmm.
of the intelligence, the political parties, and so on, of the Saigon, the former Saigon regime. And then we were in the Thu Duc prison, just in the suburb of Saigon,
mm-hmm.
for just a few weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And one morning we were assembled and gathered in the courtyard of the prison, and then chained, literally chained two by two. We were taken to the airport, and then flown to North Vietnam. So we landed in the Jhelum Airport, which was the military airport of Hanoi. And we were taken to a camp called Camp A-15,
mm-hmm.
just about 30 miles out of Hanoi.
Mm-hmm.
That is the village of Ha Tay, just about a couple of hours drive on the bad roads in North Vietnam. So I landed there and stay there from 1975 to 1980.
Mm-hmm.
I was not moved anywhere, but many of the other prisoners were moved from one camp to another for various reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I was put there with what we would call the crème de la crème. And we were there also with the generals of the Saigon army, but those high-ranking army officers were completely isolated from the
right.
rest of the civilians.
Right. And I remember you saying there was a wall there.
A very big wall.
And you couldn't see over.
Couldn't see. And now and then we can, we could see them going to work in the
mm-hmm.
fields and so on. But that was much later on. At the beginning it was completely isolated. And of course, there was no visit whatsoever for the first 4 years. And we were allowed to send letters home and receive letters from home, but the families didn't know at all where we were. When we were in the Saigon area, of course it was not difficult for the families to find out,
mm-hmm.
but when we were flown to North Vietnam, then completely blackout. There was a kind of a dispatching point at the Chi Hoa prison, the largest prison in the Saigon, there to send packages, to send letters, to send money if you want, to the prisoners.
Mm-hmm.
But the family didn't know. In my case, it was rather special, and because my family was able to find out after about a couple of years where I was, because they guessed, and the relatives, the communist relatives, I would say,
mm-hmm.
in our family also guessed that in my case I would be in North Vietnam rather than in the camps in South Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
and of course through the Catholic channels, because even in the north you have the quite a Catholic community there, they channel back news from where I was, just outside Hanoi, to the nuns, the Catholic nuns in the Saigon area. And when I was with the welfare ministry in 1966, I helped a lot of those Catholic nuns. Mm-hmm. And of course they rushed to my parents to pass the word that I was at the Hatay camp, you know, Camp A-50 in North Vietnam. So my parents were able to know that I was in North Vietnam at the, that camp. But in many families, they didn't know.
It took 2 years for this war to get south.
To get to get the words back.
So did you know that they knew?
No, I didn't know that.
Okay.
Until I came, until I got words from my family, and they were only able to communicate with me in the fourth year, because at that time that was the beginning of the visits. And my family had people to go there and visit me. Among the very first visitors, I was the privileged ones to receive visits from my family. Mm-hmm. Among the very first ones. Mm-hmm. And that was my aunt who went there.
Your aunt?
Yeah, okay. Claiming to be my sister, because only the direct relatives were allowed to go and visit. That is to say, your parents, your wife or children, or your brothers and sisters. So my aunt was the one who dared, go there, because she was a bit Viet Cong too.
She was a bit Viet Cong?
Yes, yes. She was ever sympathetic to the Viet Cong during that period.
How was did, when you saw, did you know she was coming?
No, I didn't know until she came and I was notified there's a visitor. There was a visitor for me. And when I first, appear at the place where they allow the visitor family to come and visit, my aunt then cried out right away, very loud, "I am your sister. I am your sister. I come here to visit you." And I didn't know what she was doing, So very, honestly, I said, "My aunt, what are you doing here?"
What did she do?
And then she continued to say, "I am your sister. I'm your sister."
What kind of room was this? Was this outside in a courtyard, or was it inside of a
It's
room?
Still inside the prison.
Right.
There's a place which was, a kind of an office near the offices of the guards and so on.
Okay.
So that was it.
Okay. Let me ask you about those 4 years before you had a visitor. How did you handle that, the separation from your family?
The first year was terrible. Mm-hmm. It was terrible, firstly, mentally, for me. Mm-hmm. And not knowing what happened to the family, at home. I didn't know anything about, what happened to my parents or other members of the family. So that was a real, anguish, very acute anguish.
How did you go from being so busy and so having such important tasks in your everyday life to being in prison and having no tasks?
Yes. And completely, for the first year, there was nothing to do. They didn't make us do anything. So we just linger around there the whole day and whole evening before extension of the light. And then legally, we should be locked up, from 5 p.m. to 5 a.m. That is for the night, strictly, locked up in your cells. And we didn't know anything what was happening outside, and they did not bother at all to tell what would happen to us. We just continue to remain there doing nothing, literally nothing. And I had the impression that probably the authorities at the time did not know exactly what they would like to do with us. That was my impression. Mm-hmm. See. And so they just gave us the 2 meals a day, you know, and a little bit of so-called breakfast, and the whole regime, if you can call it that way, is to legally we were granted 15 kilos of so-called cereals. Mm-hmm. That is to say, either rice or flour, wheat flour, or even some kind of vegetables, which would be considered as the equivalent to the rice or other kind of cereals, you know, like corn or oats and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But the 15 kilos of what we got most of the time was the Russian wheat flour.
Okay.
It came from Haiphong, and then trucks of the prison would go there to bring back the flour. But when it arrived at the kitchen, the 15 kilos per head would be something like 10 to 12 maximum.
Why?
Well, loss during the transportation
okay.
process
okay.
and so on and so forth. And so you would be given then about, I don't know, 150 grams or something for your meal.
Mm-hmm.
And in the morning, and it's kind of a dough that they steam it, so it's it would look like a biscuit here, you call it.
Okay.
But not brown at all, it's not baked, it's steamed. And in the morning, breakfast would consist of a quarter of that 150 gram thing.
And so you're holding, and just for the record, you're holding
yeah.
your hand out. It fit in your hand.
Oh yes,
it's very small.
It it's like a, it's the size of a biscuit here.
Okay.
You know, and that you would cut in four for four people.
Did you cut it? Did they cut it for you, or did
no? We had to cut it ourselves.
Okay.
But then everybody watched very carefully how you cut your thing to be very equitable for
mm-hmm.
the four people to
mm-hmm.
share that thing. And then for lunch, you also have a whole one. You know, and then for dinner you have a whole one.
Okay, so and a quarter, a whole, and a whole.
And a whole and a whole.
Okay.
You see, and that would be in the end about the equivalent of 10 kilos a month. You know.
Gosh.
And I said that dough, steamed dough,
mm-hmm.
period. Nothing else.
That's all you have.
Yeah. So legally that's what we had.
Water to drink?
Yeah. So the water, we wouldn't be able to know running water at all. But the kitchen would provide you with some kind of a hot drink. That is, they boil it in order to be, you know, drinkable.
Mm-hmm.
And then they had some kind of some kind of leaves from a tree in North Vietnam, which they try it and use it in lieu of instead of tea. And so you have a reddish kind of beverage that you drink, and you have to drink that. Because if you drink something else, you're dead.
It's right.
So we have then we had then that kind of drink and that dough for each meal, and then 2 spoonfuls of salted water. That is to go with the dough to give some taste to it,
you
a salted
would,
taste.
What, would you put it on top of the dough?
Oh well,
or did you eat it from the
I dip it into it, so
yeah.
make it a bit salted.
Right,
and you are not supposed to keep that after your meal. You have to throw it on the ground because the salted water can be used to rot the bars of the windows.
Right,
so they were very careful to control that you accumulate that kind of salted water or not, and it would be a very major offense if you. Had accumulated that there.
Did
that
they
sold the water.
Did they have a guard watching you the whole time while you?
Well, yes, they have it you know, permanently.
Mm-hmm.
Except from 5 p.m. to 5 a.m., we would be locked up in the cell. But you have then guards,
mm-hmm.
patrols going round and round on those cells. But during the day, there were guards in the courtyard and going about. They did not give the impression they watched you. They were busy with their things and all, and we were completely free to move around, you know, in the camp, in the courtyard, doing nothing for a whole year.
Was it grass or dirt?
It was just dirt.
Okay.
Completely, no grass whatsoever.
Now, I'm interested, they let you have knives to cut your food.
Couldn't they be used
as a weapon or
possibly? No, they didn't give us anything, but we managed to find something to do that by ourselves.
Okay.
So most of the time we use pieces of bamboo that can be made of kind of a wooden knife, mm-hmm. and we cut it. Nobody was allowed even a razor blade.
Right.
And so we began to have our beards and mustache growing.
So you grew a beard? You had a beard?
Yes, and everybody had it because there was nothing to, except those who didn't have much beard or the uh-huh. thing. But I looked like much more, that guess, like an Arab than a Vietnamese for that first year. And what they did do was to make us listen to Hanoi radio whole day long.
In the courtyard?
The communist the fashion, mm-hmm. were very loud speakers all over the camp. It's not only for us, the prisoners, but mm-hmm. everybody, for the even people in the hamlet around the mm-hmm. nearby. And of course, at the locking time by 5 p.m., as soon as the steel door of the cell was locked, we were assembled in the cell to listen to the reading of the Nhân Dân newspaper, that is the official organ of the Vietnam Communist Party.
Mm-hmm.
That would last about an hour. Most of us would probably sleep too,
really?
During the during the lecture.
Who would read it?
They designated, one of the inmates to read it.
Oh, okay. And your barracks again? Were they? Was it a communal barrack? Or
yes.
Was it individual cells?
Yeah. In that camp A15, there were about a dozen barracks like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I was put in the only brick barrack, the sole only brick barrack there, which was used, in fact, to have the U.S. prisoners of war before 1973. And there was inscriptions there on the concrete that it was for the U.S. The prisoners.
Do you remember?
That was the only brick barrack. And that barrack would hold about 100 people.
Okay.
You see, there was nothing, wooden bunks. Mm-hmm. On both sides, and that would be, I would say, about 5 or 6 meters wide, see, and probably about 25 meters long. That would house 100 people.
Pretty small.
Two layers of bunks.
Do you remember what the inscription said?
1973. Tù binh Mỹ, that means American POWs.
Okay.
I don't know who wrote it then.
Right. Did you see any markings, marking days or months?
No, nothing.
Nothing like that?
Nothing. It was very high up.
Okay.
I don't know who wrote that. But the other barracks were just in kind of, hay, straw, mud type. You see that kind with a thatched roof,
mm-hmm.
With the leaves of a thatched type of roof.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was that after a few months, probably 3 or 4 months, then we had a big kind of storm, and all the mud barracks collapsed. Except for the one I was in,
mm-hmm.
in brick, and so the commanding officer, Major Jung, I remember his name, a very nice guy. He was on the verge of retiring, full
mm-hmm.
Colonel, and he was really distraught at that time, because that morning when we all woke up. His camp was almost completely destroyed, and then he was there lamenting that how can I, find the means now to repair the barracks.
He's out there in front of you.
Yeah, we were all there because we were collecting things, trying to put things together,
mm-hmm.
And then and the storm happened during the night, and that was a really a traumatic thing for the other inmates in those barracks. And there were people there. We were all standing there. It was kind of a family atmosphere with that commanding officer, Major Jung. I'm sorry, not a colonel, Major.
Okay.
And some of the inmates there said that, well, you know, we need some cement and bricks, and we can build ourselves these barracks. And the major there, I said, sure, but how can we get the bricks? And even more difficult, the cement, you know. So they were there discussing a lot, and then a little bit later, he was there talking to me. I was there also with others, and I said, well, if we don't have any bricks, any cement, what will we do now? And Major Jung said, that's the very big problem. I have to put the request to the higher authorities and so on. I said, well, why don't we try to find our ways and, you know, help ourselves, because we cannot wait. The higher authorities. I asked him how long it would take. He said maybe a year before they answer you. Wow. Things like that. Because it was on the principle of self-help, you know. That was the way they operate. So I said to Major Jung, we have a couple of ponds out there, you know.
A couple of what?
Ponds.
Okay.
Yeah, big ones. And that was used for everything. You wash your clothes in there, you wash yourselves in there again, and you get the water from there to filter a little bit and use it for your kitchen and for taking a bath or something. That is the only source of water that you have there.
So you didn't bathe in the pond, you took the water to another facility?
In principle, we try and bring it into a basin. And then from there we filter it, you know, and get so-called potable water to use.
Right.
But it was so dirty, it's a pump. Because you even have toilets over the pump, as you have may have seen in the countryside.
The toilets are over the pond.
Yeah, as you know.
Yes,
let's sit over, you know, those benches there. And then they also breed fish in there. You know, that is how you have the toilets on the pond. That is how you fish you feed the fish. That is the traditional way to raise fish, you know, in the countryside.
Okay, so let me get this straight. You had two ponds.
Yeah.
And the toilets were located over the ponds.
That is, there were some toilets there, but it was mainly aim at feeding the fish.
Okay.
Because in our barracks we also have our toilets.
Okay.
In, for example, in my cell we had four holes above ground, you see, and that were the toilets.
Who would use the toilets out there by the pond?
Oh, the people, anybody.
Anyone.
That is, you are welcome. You're welcome to do that in order to feed the fish.
Okay. So human waste.
And many of the inmates also jump into there after a day's work, you know, to refresh themselves and to wash a little bit of their clothes too in the hot season.
You've got human waste. You have fish being bred in there. You have people washing themselves.
Yeah.
Use it for your water after you boil it.
And then water the plants and the vegetables and so on. Everything there. So I said to Major Jung, we can try an empty one, see, and use the clay there to make bricks. And I said, if I'm not mistaken, there are a number of guys from the Biên Hòa area among the inmates. And the Biên Hòa area, just outside Saigon, you know, about 50 miles outside Saigon, that's where they make the bricks, the tiles for the whole of the Saigon area. Very well known for that activity. I'm sure that we can make the bricks and the ties there if we have the kind of thing to know them to do that. You see, and Major Jung said yes, but where would we find the combustion? You know, to make the fire.
The fire.
There's no coal. There's
the
no
the kiln for
yeah,
a kiln.
The kiln.
Right.
Say, well, we can gather the branches. Lots of trees all around there in that area. So you must have branches. You must have kind of trees there that you can use. I said, we can try that. And that's what we did.
Really?
The 1,000-something inmates there began to empty the pond.
With what?
With the traditional way. Uh-huh. You know, they have big quarts there, and you have a kind of how do you call it? You use it with the bamboo type thing to have big basket, you know? And then that is how two guys on both sides with those quarts. You can just, you know.
Right, okay. Yes, yeah. I've seen this. They're kind of slinging
so
they, it.
Yeah,
back
we can empty the whole thing. So everybody did that.
And
lots of clay there.
Did it go into the other pond or just out onto the...
Out into the
dirt.
Thing, yeah. Because the other pond was rather far away.
Okay.
That pond, not very near. But we managed to empty the pond.
Okay.
And then lots of clay. So we went down in there and, you know, took out chunks of clay. And we passed out, you know, 1,000 guys.
What about
that.
The fish?
Well, they, of course, went somewhere. We didn't
right.
know. You know, the guards took care of that.
Uh-huh.
There was not many anyway. And we managed to have it. And we began to have the bricks and the ties. And we had that kiln built.
Built a kiln.
And it was, I think, a kiln. That kiln was able to make 8,000 bricks at each becking.
Really?
And then it was, you know, a big success.
Mm-hmm.
And Major Young also said, well, now we have to find the cement to build. And I was the one to tell him, we sell the bricks and the tile. That's all. So we were
buy the cement.
Yeah, we were producing like mad. And there was no no supply of bricks and tiles in that area, you know, before.
Mm-hmm.
So we were... For the first time, they were able to supply bricks and tile to the locals instead of you know, having to go somewhere else to bring them back.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a big success. And we began to build our own prison there in the following years.
How many buildings did you build?
Well, we were all there, about 10 teams of masons. And we built, I think, about nearly 15 barracks.
Wow.
Yeah. And it became the most beautiful and the showcase of the whole of North Vietnam. You know, the prison showcase.
Mm-hmm.
That's where they took Amnesty International, the Red Cross and other visitors to go and have a look there.
Mm.
And for the construction experience there, I became a mason. And then I was given the task of, you know, making beautiful the whole prison after we finished the barracks.
Mm-hmm.
So to design the gardens, fish ponds, flower beds, and things like that. So I had the best job in the camp with 5 or 7 other guys.
So you were like a landscaped architect.
Yes.
Designing. How did
and they left us very much alone because we were in creative work. So they did not come and push you to work hard or anything like the other groups, you know, working in the fields
mm-hmm.
or doing something else. So we were very relaxed.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, we produced kind of the, you know, garden pottery,
mm-hmm.
all those things that you grow flowers in.
Mm-hmm.
And I, together with the friends there, I tried to imitate a kind of, you know, porcelain ceramic things
mm-hmm.
For those flower beds and so on. So we did it with the cement only, you know, and then we used paint. to paint outside,
mm-hmm.
it gave the real impression to be ceramics, you know,
mm-hmm.
with all kinds of
mm-hmm.
colors. It became very famous because the people in the area came and asked to buy,
really?
And put orders. And it was so successful that we had orders from Hanoi. And it was, you know, something of a big event
mm-hmm.
For the prison authority and Major Duke, because we had an order from Prime Minister Pham Van Dam
Really?
To buy a couple of very big, you know, those vases.
Urns?
Urns there for the Prime Minister's office in Hanoi. And then we also had orders from the Bat Mai Hospital and various ministries.
Mm-hmm.
And so the poor commanding officer, the Camp Major Yong, said, "Fong, how much should I charge, you know, for those things? We cannot give them away." Mm-hmm. They don't give, they didn't give anything away. And so I said, "Well, how much would it cost outside, you see? Whatever the price, you know, outside, you just charge them."
Mm-hmm.
He said, "That's a very high price." I said, "Okay, go to the market price."
Mm-hmm.
And we were able to sell at those prices. Nobody questioned the prices because, you know, big shots, mm-hmm. you just pay.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were able to make an income, you know.
Now, who kept the money?
Yeah, the camp, of course.
The camp,
yeah,
the camp,
the
camp kitty.
But then, the camp kitty.
Okay.
But then, I and the guys who produce and manufacture those articles of art there, you know, we were given a monthly allowance, you know. That is, what would say, it was 15 dongs, I think.
15?
Dongs.
15 dongs.
Yeah. And at that time, the average salary of a middle level civil servant would be about 50 dongs.
50?
Yeah.
So you were making 15 a month?
So, 50. Not bad at all.
No. Not bad for a prisoner.
Yeah. But those things sold for hundreds, you know, of dongs.
Have you ever thought about trying to find those pieces of art after you left the camp? And
I have never returned to the camp, but I doubt very much that you could.
But I mean, in Hanoi or the places where
yes,
you sold them?
Personally, that did not appeal to me to return anyway.
Right.
So that was the, you know, about the construction of the camp.
Hmm.
But for the first year, we didn't do anything. It was only in the second year that we began to work. And labor teams were formed. And it was a big encouragement in some way, because we were told that the, you know, labor camps were different from real prison.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, we were imprisoned there. And I think with the camps in South Vietnam, we were, I mean, truthfully, I must say that it would be about 200,000 of former officials and officers and so on of the former Saigon regime who were really, you know, officially in the, in re-education camps. I would say about 200,000. And we were kept there. Legally, you would call it administrative confinement.
Mm-hmm.
We were not tried in any court. We were not informed of anything. We were just kept there. And I also remember that during the war with the Saigon government, we also had that administrative, you know, measure mm-hmm. against a number of you know, suspects and people that we considered were, you know, the enemy.
So you do the same
so,
thing.
So he then received the same treatment anyway.
Right.
You see. And so we were waiting to be told what would happen to us, but we were never told.
Did you have a problem with that? Because you had spent so much time in the West, in Paris, in France, and then in London you spent so much time. And then having faced a situation where you had no legal recourse at all, no trial, no explanation,
no communication.
No judge, no communication.
Yeah.
How did you feel about that?
Well, you know, it was very strange for me. I did not question the legality or anything in that respect.
Mm-hmm.
I was just, you know, very eager to be told what would happen to us. That's all. Whether we would be tried, we would have to do 10 years or 20 years, anything,
mm-hmm.
instead of not being told anything at all, you see. And so I was mainly concerned with, you know, being told, whatever it might be,
mm-hmm.
but to be told, that's all. And then the greatest worry was the fate And then what happened to the people at home?
Mm-hmm.
You know, my parents and all the members of the family. These were the two main things that you know bothered me really. But I did not really, you know, trying to say, well, I would be, you know, harshly punished or not. I would be treated well or not. That did not really worry me. But I was really eager to be told.
Were you ever told anything?
Never. And they had never, you know, done that with anybody.
Hmm.
Even after the 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
That is by 1979. There were the very first isolated cases of release.
Mm-hmm.
That's special cases.
From your prison?
From my camp, yes, from my prison.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 1980, you had more,
mm-hmm.
and more, and then afterwards you had big groups,
mm-hmm.
you know, being released.
Did you ever ask anyone, Major Yeung, to, you know, tell me what's happening and how long will we be here?
No, I didn't ask him, because I couldn't bring myself to ask. And so I just wait for them to tell.
Was that a pride thing?
I think so.
Yeah.
See, I think so. I wouldn't like to let them see how I feel.
Right.
And we were never told on which criteria or for what reasons
mm-hmm.
They make those the releases.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a mixture, such a mixture that you can never guess any kind of criteria.
No pattern.
No pattern whatsoever. I think it was done on purpose, so that nobody can claim I meet the requirements.
Right.
No. And we had the old, the young, the military, the civilians, you know, the high ranking, low ranking,
mm-hmm.
all kinds of things.
What do you think now? Why were people released, looking back at it? What were the criteria now, looking at it?
I think that there was a need for them to release, you know, after 4 or 5 years.
Okay.
It was big pressure on the part of the international community. I think the U.S. also, you know, keep on trying to get all those people in re-education out, you see. And also, probably the Hanoi authorities found out by that time that we would not be in a position to do anything really drastic or harsh to the regime. So they began to release, you know, I would say cases which would not present too much of a problem. And I don't know why it happened to be among the first ones. And probably thanks to my confession of 37 pages instead of 100,000 pages of the other inmates, I said, well, what I did was at the negotiating table, and probably, you know, Mr. Le Duc Thanh and Mr. Sun Thi would know, and Madam Minh would know much more than I do what happened in the negotiations. So that was the only thing that I can could report.
Have you ever, do you know what happened to those 37 pages? Did you ever see them again?
No, never. But I was also, I also had a visit from a Vice Minister of the Interior.
Mm-hmm.
Rather relatively old guy. He must be in his late 60s or something. He was probably one of the heroes during the French colonial period. He also experienced, you know, prison and so on during the French colonial period. And he was a kind of major general,
mm-hmm.
or vice minister of the interior for security.
Mm-hmm.
He came with two young guys one Sunday and told me that about 18, exactly 18 of my high-ranking relatives in the Hanoi government petitioned and vouched to have me released in their custody.
Mm-hmm.
And so the big shot came down just to inform me, laughingly, that there were 18 of my relatives, you know, three-star generals, party secretary and things like vice minister and so on in the Hanoi government vouching for me.
Mm-hmm.
But regretfully, the government and the party could not release you with yet. So I also, you know, put a job back. I said that you can see, you know, I was very skinny by
mm-hmm.
that time
mm-hmm.
already. I dropped from nearly 160 pounds to about 90 pounds by that time. And I said to him, you know, I don't weigh much, you know, how come that I'm much heavier than the 18 high-ranking, you know, officials of your regime? With big laugh there.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the time when the I became a kind of relationship with that Vice Minister, the Interior, mm-hmm. and then through him later on to another general who was responsible for all the prisons, you know, of the country.
Okay.
And he was a very, his hobby was gardening.
Garden.
And all those kinds of pots and vases and mm-hmm. urns that you put in the garden and so on. So when he heard that we were making it, producing it, and then the Prime Minister's office had it and other ministers, he went down and visited me, usually on Sundays, to discuss about those things, you know. And so I tried to run him down, you know, ancient Greece architecture to ancient Rome architecture and so on and so forth, and inform him of all kinds of vases that they had in those days. Of course, he was very conservative in his artistic, mm-hmm. you know, outlook. And eventually, I brought him to very modern shapes, you know, and so on. And then he came very often,
mm-hmm.
and he even tried to bring me some food,
really,
you know, fresh fish.
Sneak it in,
yeah.
Or
no, he
just openly.
Openly, uh-huh. He gave me two or three fish. Probably, you know, the troops, his soldiers, fishing somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, and then
let me interrupt just a second to change the disc. We're almost out of time here.
Oh, we stop a few minutes.
Okay, we're starting a new disc.
Go ahead.
So that general, who was the head director mm-hmm. of all the what they call the eradication.
Mm-hmm.
The department of the Ministry of the Interior, he came very often on Sundays
mm-hmm.
to discuss, you know, arts with me. And each time he brought, you know, two or three fish, things like that, a piece of meat
mm-hmm.
To give me, because it was very rare to mm-hmm. have, you know, meat and fish and so on.
Would you share with the others, or would you go ahead and eat that yourself?
Because we have a group of 10 for our meals.
Right.
We were dividing group of 10, so we eat together.
Mm-hmm.
So I pull in the whatever I got for the 10.
Okay.
And it was he who, you know, by November 1979,
mm-hmm.
who is by the end of the 4 years,
mm-hmm.
he passed a few hints. He passed to me a few hints. He asked me, Fong, what would you do, you know, after your release? And I said, well, I don't really know. I probably, first of all, I have to go back to my own parents. They were by themselves.
Mm-hmm.
No one to take care of them. I was very worried about my own parents. And I said, well, if you were released, would you continue to remain in Vietnam, or would you prefer to go abroad,
mm-hmm.
or return to France and so on, because I had a family in France too.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, it depends. I mean, on the government and the party, you know, to decide what I would be allowed to do, and then I will see. But I have also my obligations with my very old age father and mother in Saigon. I am very worried about them. So it kept on like that,
mm-hmm.
you know, one Sunday after another. And it was then, by that time, the beginning of December 1979. And then one day I was called and informed, together with about 8 or 9 others. I remember our group were about 8 or 9, and we were told that we would be released, and they would try very much to get us back by Christmas, to allow us to enjoy Christmas and New Year. That was by the end of 1979.
Mm-hmm.
But they could not find the guards to escort us back to Saigon, because that was the practice, that each group of prisoners were released and sent back home to Saigon, a guard on the camp would go there and you know, accompany us until we arrive in Saigon and report to the police there. And so for my release, they did not have any guards, and Major Jung called all of us, the 8 or 9 that we were allowed to go home then, and said, well, I thought you would be the head of the delegation and take them back to Saigon. he played on the words, of course. You
right,
know.
Right.
But it was really great anxiety, you know, in the first or second years of the imprisonment there, because we found out that in the camp there, Camp A-15, there were also common criminals, you know, separate in a section in their barracks, and there were also another group, about 15 of them, who were the former Saigon commandos, you know, thrown airborne over North Vietnam for sabotage missions during the time of President Diem. And the one with the longest internment there, among the 15, were in his 18th year. And so,
wow.
But they were very, you know, very, shall we say, united together. You know, that group of about 15, they didn't speak much to others outside. They kept to themselves.
Did you have much contact with them?
Not much. I mean, we had hellos and things like that, because they did not mix with the rest, and they were the separate. You know, they did their work. They were in the in the woodwork section, carpenters. And they did that for years. But I must mention that in addition to those former Saigon commanders, we had also the common criminals, and there were very two interesting cases, funny cases too. There was a very young guy who was probably 20 years old, skinny, tiny chap, and very dark skin, you know. And he was the only survivor in the whole family. He had five brothers, and his father, together with the other four brothers, were, to say, heroes of the revolution. They fought and they died, you know, during the war. So he
against
was
France or against
his father was during the French period, and his brothers were during the American period.
Okay.
And of course, he was considered, you know, a very exceptional case of what they called the hero of the revolution. And his mother was also the head of the Women's Association, Revolutionary Women Association, in Hanoi, of the Hai Ba Trưng district, which, I, you know, is the central, very central district in Hanoi. And what happened to that young chap when he was still in his teens, I think about 17 or 18? He was walking around the lake in Hanoi with his girlfriend. And there were three or four guys trying to make a pass at his girlfriend.
Around Hoan Kiem Lake?
Yeah, the Hoan Kiem Lake, you see. And the Golden Salt Lake. And then the little chap, you know, member of the family of heroes, highly respected, he just knifed one of those four guys to death. But considering his family and so on, and also a kind of, you know, the minor, not the adult yet, so he was kept in the youth reeducation center. But he was so bad that they put him in our prison, and he was there with the common criminals. But that guy was really Houdini, you know, reincarnated, because he managed to escape jail, you know, several times.
Really?
You know, through the roof, and then jump outside without being detected. And the next morning, of course, of each of his evasion and escape from the prison there, Mei Jinyong just laughed. He said, "Well, in a few days he will be back here." And very often his mother took him back.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
Because he would go home, to be with his mother. And she would convince him that you had to return to jail, because you had to be in jail, and he had rather, preferential treatment. But that's one case which was rather funny. Nobody really worried when he escaped.
Would his mother walk him back to jail? Or
yeah, but then, in the end, the final part of his story, when I was still there at the camp, he escaped. But he didn't return.
Okay.
And then he didn't go back to his mother.
Okay.
Who was a very high-ranking official, being the head chair person of the Women's Association and so on. And we learned later on that he went to Da Nang and joined the hooligans there and disappeared, in the wilderness. So that was the case of that little guy. But there was also another very interesting case. The daughter of Naomi Kernel, also hero of the revolution and so on. And she was a really wild sea in Hanoi.
Uh-huh.
And did bad things there and so on and so forth. That eventually the father had to put her in jail there, And she was there, responsible for the administrative things in the office.
Okay.
And so on. But then she began to get hold of the young guards there.
How old was she?
She was about 19 or so.
Okay.
Yeah. And she had then two lovers. One was the guard responsible for the kitchen, and the other one was the one responsible for the blacksmith section of the jail. Really, big guy, a blacksmith type, really.
Mm-hmm.
And so everybody knew that these two were his were her lovers.
Mm-hmm.
And then one day she had the bright idea to steal, the things which belong to the inmates. Because when you get into jail, you have to surrender your rings, your watches, and your wallets and everything, your money. And they put it in two big cupboards, in the office. And so she managed to take a number of those things, the packages at the back.
Mm-hmm.
So in front still there.
Mm-hmm.
But it became empty and empty each day. And it was then eventually discovered.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened was that she convinced her boyfriend in the kitchen to bury most of those watches and rings and so on and so forth in a small wall where they raised the pigs, just behind the kitchen.
Okay.
And together with the blacksmith, they begin to enjoy, the results of robbery.
This is near the kitchen, though.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And so with the blacksmith, she passed on the watches and so on to be sold in Hanoi.
Okay.
So usually during the weekend, they would go out to Hanoi, which was not very far from our camp, about 30 miles.
Mm-hmm.
And it was detected in Hanoi by the police, eventually, that it was supplied by the blacksmith in the camp. And so it was discovered.
Okay.
Eventually, all the three were arrested. And were taken away to another prison. So that's the case of the daughter of the colonel.
Interesting. She was able to leave the camp and travel to Hanoi on the weekends.
Yes, they were free to go, and they did that to for fun. Because it's not very far from the capital city.
You don't know what happened to her?
No, we didn't hear anything. But they were. Convicted in court, and so they had their sentences.
Okay.
So that was for the inmates there. And of course, when the labor teams were set up, we had all kinds of activities. And right at the beginning, I was not with the Mason group yet, but for just a few days only, I was with the what they call the agricultural, the vegetable group, and then I was put on the building thing. But there were those labor teams, and those who work in the fields would go out of the prison and stay there the whole day, return only in the evening before 5 p.m. And that they would carry their so-called lunch with them to when they work in the field. The others inside the camp then would have their lunch in the camp.
What kind of clothing were you issued?
Oh, we had a uniform. You know, kind of pajamas, of course, but all blue. Not very dark blue, but a kind of you know, blue. And we were given two pajamas, set of pajamas a year. One straw hat and kind of, you know, sandals made out of the ties. So that's what we had. One blanket, one mosquito net, straw mat, that was it. But we had legally our share of toothpaste, sugar, what else? Sugar, toothpaste and soap, every quarter. And even the villagers outside didn't have that. The guards didn't have that. But through the law, by the revocation, the regulations, the Ministry of Interior provided us with those things. And most of us just sold those things to the villagers to buy other things, you know, to buy food, to buy cakes and things like that.
What kind of contact did you have with the villagers?
Through the guards, rather.
Through the guards?
Yeah, through the guards only. They came and then they would say they would like to buy the soap, the toothpaste and things like that. And we would pass through the guards and get the money. In exchange, we would get the so-called cakes, you know, the kind of moon cake in the north. They do it the whole year long, probably during the moon cake season. Only. It was very hard, you know. But that was better than nothing.
Did you pay the guards a little bit of money to be the middleman?
No, there's no need. It was so little money, you know, it would impress everybody. Nothing at all.
How did you get on with the guards?
I got on very well. They were very courteous to me. They were from the other sections where, you know, they had rough times with the guards. But not in our, you know, the only brick cell building. The guards there probably were chosen, you know, among the better ones to be courteous and relatively speaking of a much higher education and culture compared to the other guards.
Did they know who you were, your stature in the former
Saigon
government?
Vaguely.
Okay. Your visits with this colonel who would visit you on Sundays, did you... how did you feel about that? Were you welcome to or open to this process, or did you feel any kind of resentment towards the
old guy? I was very open, you know, the one who went through the French War. He was very open, but the two young ones were really tough. And even you know, at one time, I had the impression that they were going to beat me up.
Really?
You know, if there were no old guy there.
Why?
Well, they were really antagonistic to the prisoners and you know, generally speaking, probably they had reasons to you know, had a big crush against me or us, the former Saigon regime people. But the old man was rather friendly, and I made quite an impression then eventually on the two young guys too, because one Sunday I think almost a couple of years after our arrival there, they came down one Sunday and asked me to sign some papers.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, what kind of papers? He said, well, the papers to release the bank accounts in Paris which belong to the Saigon delegation. I was the one to sign that for the bank.
Mm-hmm.
And it was probably about $2 million or something.
Really?
Which was still in the bank, and that was the BNP or something.
Mm-hmm.
And they were really tense that Sunday morning when they came down to us.
Mm-hmm.
Because they expected me to refuse to sign. When they expect me, they said, this is the people's money, it's not my own money, you know, and then you know, it belongs to the government, whichever, of Vietnam. And the old man said that the bank insists that they must have my signature to release the funds to anyone.
Mm-hmm.
So if I accept the release now to the government of Vietnam, they would do it. But without my signature, they wouldn't do it.
Okay. Mm.
Of course, the Hanoi government, you know, claimed through the French government that all those accounts belong to them. But then I think the bank, you know, played a game with them. Said that the account was for the delegation of the Republic of Vietnam, but it was, you know, under the authorization of Mr. Nguyễn Xuân Phong. And so we need the agreement of Mr. Nguyễn Xuân Phong to release that fund to anybody according to his instructions.
Mm-hmm.
Unless he's no longer alive, then it would be another thing. But if no proof of his death is provided to the bank, then we need his signature. I signed right away the thing, and they were very surprised. Because I didn't put any condition, I didn't ask for my release or anything. Or that's all. Mm-hmm. That is the people's money.
How long into your internment did this happen?
Well, I said it would be about 2 years.
Two years.
Yeah, so right bit in the middle.
Hmm.
A little bit more.
Did you have any thoughts of putting up a condition? Or
bargaining? Yes, I did. But in the end, I thought that it would be, you know, not a good thing to do, or that it would not reflect, you know, really what I am. So there is no reason for me to refuse.
I'm sure that made an impression.
And some of the only the friends I had in my cell, you know, particularly the Vice Minister of Education of Information, he is a very nice chap. Much younger, he said that you should not have, you know, given the thing so easily. You could have asked for something in return, a special treatment, or that the house arrest or something of that kind instead of prison. I said that I thought of it, but I don't think that's worth, you know, claiming that. But I also said that it would be a bit, you know, unfair for the rest. I would prefer to share the whole common lot than trying to play anything by myself.
Did they treat you differently after this?
No. I think they didn't inform anybody.
I'm sure it worked.
And later on I was informed that the bank in Paris released the money to the government.
How did you feel about that?
Nothing.
Nothing.
Nothing. I've been interested in money anyway.
How did the guards address you? Was it Mr. Phong, Ambassador Phong, or Ong Phong?
No, An Phong.
An?
Yeah, brother.
But you were older than them, right?
Not much. Much. There were lots of old guys there. The old inmates there did not fare very well. It was Most of them, it was the first contact with, you know, the cold weather in the north. They never had anything there, and many of them didn't even go to Da Lat to know the cold in South Vietnam. And most of them passed away.
Really?
They could not, you know, because of the lack of food.
Mm-hmm.
There was no clothing, because we had only those two pajamas and whatever we had with us at that time. And they could not deal with the cold weather there. And it was really cold because it was, you know, in the winter time, 0°C.
Wow.
Yeah.
How did you stay warm? Blanket and pajamas?
Yeah,
and that's
and
it?
Whatever you can, you could lay your hands on.
Mm-hmm.
In, cardboard, newspaper and so on, you just wrap yourself with all these things.
Mm-hmm.
I managed to, I had the habit of using lots of, you know, towels, bath towels. So when I went to education, I brought several, you know, big towels with me.
Mm-hmm.
That helped a lot.
Yeah.
I cut it into, you know, socks and gloves,
mm-hmm.
and vests and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And so that helped me a lot. But the others didn't have any, you know, those
mm-hmm.
things.
Mm-hmm.
It was only in the fourth year they began to receive things, really, clothing and medicine. And that's also something, you know, rather remarkable,
mm-hmm.
because when we began to receive those parcels from our family,
mm-hmm.
the people in the guards there were really, you know, flabbergasted to see so much wealth in a package, you know, medicines,
right.
really a lot, all kinds of things in there, you know, clothing and so on. And I work out, you know, the value of those packages that we, the inmates, each of us receive. It was an, in the average, the wealth, the value, which would be equivalent to about 5 to 10 years' salary of a civil servant in North Vietnam.
Wow. So it was real, they couldn't imagine.
Yeah,
where
they could not. They couldn't imagine so much wealth from the south coming up there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, especially the medicines
mm-hmm.
were very rare.
Mm-hmm. Did you share with this, or did every did people share their packages?
Well, I think the general attitude was that you try to cling on to the most, you know, vital things
right.
you need.
Mm-hmm.
But we share. We share very, you know, readily.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, thanks to that, that many you know, the inmates survived, because some of them didn't have any much, and some didn't have a lot, you know, the rich ones.
Mm-hmm. Do they address the older prisoners as Ong?
No. Old Han.
Oh, Han.
Yeah.
Did that bother them?
No, not at all.
Okay.
We were in prison, and so we accept those things.
Okay.
And, that was the practice among the communists, you know, as always.
Okay. Everybody was brother.
Yeah.
Okay.
They did not give us the comrade appellation, but they would do that among themselves. Dong
mm-hmm.
chi,
mm-hmm.
it's comrade.
Mm-hmm.
Even in Russia, they do that too.
What kind of medicines did you have? What kind of health care did they provide?
Nothing at all.
Nothing.
Nothing at all. And there was a kind of, you know, the infirmary,
mm-hmm.
you know, a health station, which was put in the hands of an inmate, but a common criminal,
mm-hmm.
Doctor, and he was the director of a state hospital, I think in Haiphong.
Okay.
And he got 18 years for shooting his wife and her lover in bed.
Okay.
And when we arrived there, he became quite a close friend. Of mine, he was in his 15th year of his 18th year verdict.
He knew he had 18 years.
Oh yes,
okay. He was told.
He was tried
right.
in court and so on. A very nice guy,
mm-hmm.
very, you know, peaceful guy. He was supposed to be responsible for the health station, the infirmary there.
He was peaceful
without anything at all.
He was peaceful despite the fact that he had murdered two people.
Oh, yes. Okay. I've been there for 15 years.
Okay.
I'm ready.
He had time to cool down.
Yeah, to cool down much. Okay. And I think that he wouldn't be better off outside or inside. For him, would be the same life, I suppose.
Okay.
And he was allowed to have a separate accommodation along the barracks of the guards.
Okay.
And he was given room there. So, special treatment. But he was considered to be a doctor. And together with, the doctors from Saigon, the inmates who came, we also had the director of the Pasteur Institute in Saigon, Dr. Ai.
Really?
A very good doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And they tried to take care of us there.
Okay.
And in fact, I had an accident. At one time there, broke two ribs. You still have now. They have not healed.
Really?
And it is broken. There was no medical care whatsoever. And the two ribs, the last two ribs down here, healed in the wrong way, like this.
Okay,
so now many of the doctors said it can be remedied very easily. You just open it again, break it again, and put it, mm-hmm. I said, no, I keep it as a souvenir.
Does it cause you pain now?
Yes, now and then, yes.
Okay.
Internal wound.
Yes.
I can feel it now. Yeah, like this.
Okay, for the record, you're holding your hands
at,
I guess, about a 45 degree angle.
Yeah.
And they're broken, pointing upward.
That is, the two ends did not join again.
Right. Okay.
And that doctor, the former director of the hospital in Haiphong, he said, Fong, I have hidden some morphine for myself.
Mm-hmm.
But I know the broken ribs hurt a lot, so I will give you the only morphine that I have on me right now.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave me that thing. To lessen the pain.
Was it an injection?
Yes, an injection.
Really?
And we found some cloth, and he gave me a bandage there. And he said there's nothing else that we could do. There was nothing we could do. Just wait to heal by itself.
Hmm.
And I was bedridden, so to say, for 2 weeks, because it was very difficult for me to move at all.
Mm. Oh,
very painful. And the guard who hit the whole incident, each day when we line up to go to our work, they would carry me to the upper bunk,
mm-hmm.
To be out of sight, and let me lie there, by myself the whole day.
Really?
For 2 weeks like that.
Hmm.
And it was not reported because the guy was afraid to be, punished,
mm-hmm.
for letting the incident, the accident happen.
What happened?
Well, it was during a work session, and kind of metal structure,
mm-hmm.
that they had in the workshop collapsed, and it fell on me. I was under those metallic bars.
Is it like scaffolding?
Yeah, to hold things. Okay. They put it up there, probably the army type things. But I was almost all right. I mean, under the fallen metallic bars there. But then one of the young guards came, and he saw me under the thing, and probably he thought he had the good idea to push away those metallic bars lying on top of me.
Mm-hmm.
And so with his military boots, he kicked those bars, but then he kicked me
right
the bars and broke my two ribs.
Oh no!
And they carried me out.
What did you say? What did you do?
I said, "You kick and broke my ribs." He broke completely two ribs.
Mm.
And then
this is on your right side.
Yeah, yeah. And now you can feel. Yeah, I suppose. Yeah.
Oh yeah, okay. Yeah, I can feel it. Yes. Wow.
It was very painful.
Was that very painful? I can imagine. Yeah. I can imagine.
And so that was the incident. And so we did make a big fuss because some of the other men said we have to report to Major Jung on this thing. And I said, no, if you do that, he will get into trouble and we'll have more trouble with him. And I thought, it's okay, we can, you know, overcome the problem by ourselves.
So he agreed to, you know, help you, and
yes,
and you agreed to not say anything.
Yes.
The other men
said anything, the others said they didn't say anything, and that doctor then tried to give me some help with that form morphine injection. And that was it. There was no medicine, not any kind.
Did Major Jung ever find out? Did he ever find out about your whips?
Oh yeah, he found out later on, of course.
What did he do?
He came and said to me that I should have reported to him. Could have given, you know, more medical care for that. Mm-hmm. Okay, to broken ribs. But there was also other, you know, very funny incident. I was in the cell with a guy by the name of Li Wenzhe. Mm-hmm. And he was at that time in the same government, the last government of the RRV, and he was the finance minister. Mm-hmm. And he was also my neighbor in Saigon for years.
Okay.
And we met for the first time when we were in Paris. Mm-hmm. During our schooling there. And he was at one time the director general of all the taxation. So everybody was after him. And he ended up as the Minister of Finance. Mm-hmm. And he had a very unusual problem that I think was about the third year. He got his testicles swollen. Big like a grapefruit.
Both of them?
Both of them.
Oh my gosh.
Each one big like a grapefruit, so the, you know, the two would be enormous volume.
Right.
He could hardly walk. He could hardly even lie down or sit or anything.
Why did this happen?
And then we took him to the director of the Pasteur Institute, Dr. Mm-hmm. I, and to that doctor, mm-hmm. you know, the former director of the Haiphong Hospital. And our Saigon doctor, who was the director of the Pasteur Institute, said, well, germ, this can be cured very easily if you had some meat or fish or shrimp, lobsters to eat, you know. And was so angry because you would never have right. those things in jail.
Right.
He wanted to jump on it and beat the doctor up to say such a stupid thing. But then, luckily for him, I think it was in the third year, as I said, that we began to receive those packages. And then, of course, there was no medicine whatsoever in the camp. Mm-hmm. That was caused by the lack of food.
Okay.
And he received his package from his family. And then the very first thing that he did, you know, that former finance minister, mm-hmm. was to take a whole can of condensed milk, make two holes, and then began to suck the whole can of condensed milk. You imagine that?
Mm.
He emptied it in almost one go.
Mm.
That helped his testicles.
Mm-hmm.
But the guy got into a diarrhea, you know, for days.
Oh.
But that was the beginning of the good days, you know, mm-hmm. when we receive our things.
Right. That was, what, 4 years?
Yes, by the end of the third year, okay. I think we began to get the packages.
Okay. Well, what happened? Visits. What happened to his testicles? Were they ever
yes,
back to normal?
Yes, they resolved, you know, to normal.
How are you doing? Shall we stop for today?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Thank you, sir.